number 313-298-WRIF. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much. Welcome, everybody. Another Sunday night in Detroit. We're broadcasting to the immediate WRIF broadcast area, which is southeastern Michigan, southern Ontario, and northern Ohio. But welcome to everyone listening on the Internet all across the country and, in fact, all across the world. I did the last week as a substitute host on a national talk network. So, hey, one of the last 7 or 8 days, I've done six. How do you figure that out? Six, seven, eight. Yeah, of the last, I can't do the math. Six, eight, of the last 9 days, I've done about 8 shows or something like that. And it's been great talking to people from all over the country and some of you as well. But my heart belongs to Detroit. Glad to be on the air in the Motor City. And also, as I said, glad to have everyone listening wherever you are. 313-298-WRIF is our phone number. And this show is like a tonic to me. Don't tell my boss, but he's probably listening, but I'd probably do this show for free. I mean, it has such an incredible effect on me. And I don't just do it for me, obviously. I do it as an interchange. It makes me be smarter about myself, smarter about the world. And, hey, if we're trading information and trading ideas, that's what the show's all about. And actually, up until just about a half an hour ago, I was in this foul mood just thinking about the world. And it made me think of my wife, my dear, darling wife, who never any longer reads the news at all. Now, it's not like she's disengaged. She takes part in the same kind of political activity that I do. We go to meetings, we go to rallies, we go to demonstrations. In fact, we're going to the big one, another one of these big ones. Hopefully it'll be a million people again telling George Bush to just shove his illegal, unconstitutional, murderous war. That's going to be April 29th in New York. So we're going to go off, visit friends, and also take part in this march on April 29th. But she says she just can't bear to read the news. And I've talked to more and more people like that. The only thing is, some people just stop reading and disengage as well. In fact, some of you, the only way you are engaged is through reading. I mean, actually, if you're really solidly engaged, you're on the Internet looking at sites that tell you some truth and not just sitting there listening to the nonsense on Fox News or CNN or reading that vile rag, the Detroit News, which I'll get to in a little while. Oftentimes, it does not appear that there's anywhere or any way to express the discomfort you have about what's happening to our city, our state, the country, the state of the world. I mean, I read some of this environmental stuff, and it just scares the hell out of me. I mean, sometimes I read that, and I think, man, it doesn't even matter whether we've got a fascist government or not. But it comes about the theme I've spoken of so many times, and that is the isolation, the atomization, the fragmentation of what used to be human communities. Communities, maybe I don't even need the adjective, as opposed to what? Communities of snails? As opposed to a community of television. Like what's called the society of the spectacle. You ever heard that phrase before? Some of you have. I know. But it's an important concept. The society of the spectacle means essentially. To some extent reinterpret it. I don't want anybody giving me a hard time about this. But essentially it means that there are passive receptors, individual fragments of human society that before used to have a sense of themselves and the world they live in through direct experience. And people reinforce that every day with a series of personal interactions, with institutions, with traditions, all of that. It explained almost, in a lot of ways, almost everything. I don't want to go to the exceptions. Now, we are these, as I said, isolated, fragmented, atomized little chips of humanity that watches primarily the spectacle through television. So Mark Crispin Miller wrote this great series of essays about television. And the last one is called Big Brother Is You Watching. Remember from 1984, Big Brother is watching you. Well, it doesn't have to do that. I mean, Big Brother is watching us. illegal unconstitutional surveillance. We know that wiretapping without breaking the law, violating the Constitution, high crimes and misdemeanors being committed by the Bush White House. And somebody like Senator Russ Feingold of Wisconsin says, shouldn't we have like pass a little motion saying this is wrong? And you know, the Democrats go, oh, man, let me out of here. And the Republicans say this is partisan politics at its worst. We have a lawbreaker sitting in the Oval Office. And no one saying anything about it. And what happens is, think about all the conservatives that talk about law and order. And if you don't enforce laws, what happens? Respect for law then becomes lessons. It lessens and lessens until then it is what it's already on the way to becoming. One man rule. One man will say, I don't care about the Geneva Accords. I'll treat prisoners the way I want. I don't care that there's American law and international law against torture. I okay torture. I don't care that there's international law and the U.S. Constitution about unilaterally going to war when there is absolutely no threat whatsoever. I'm just going to do it, and on and on and on and on like that. Where was I? Oh, yeah, that my mood and how this is all elevated by getting on this show. Hey, you can elevate your mood by getting on the show with me. 313-298-WRIF. And the fact that my wife doesn't read anything anymore. She says, I can't wake up in the morning and look at a photograph from Baghdad on the front page of the New York Times. That's what we get every morning because I got to know all the details of it. Man, every once in a while, I look at these Detroit papers and I thought, what useless pieces of fish wrap. I mean, sports. Actually, some of the automotive stuff ain't bad, but again, we'll talk about that in a little while. It is. It's almost obscene. I wonder how can they put this on the cover, or the worst, on page three, where there's always a Tiffany ad, and it shows some, let's say, diamond engagement rings, 20,000 to 1 million, and right next to it, a pile of corpses. I can't even believe that Tiffany wants that, let alone that people don't understand that. Oh, yeah, that's terrible. Let me go on. Who won the game? So it is getting difficult, and it plays into what we talked about on this national broadcast I was doing all last week. This, I don't know, I would guess fairly unreliable study by the Pew Research Center, P-E-U, not P-H-E-U, P-E-U. A research center that did this survey about who's happier, Democrats or Republicans, liberals or conservatives. And they came to the conclusion through this study that Republicans and conservatives are happier than Democrats and Democrats and liberals, let alone whacked out leftists like me, who, as you can see, can get into a... I'm laughing at something, which I'll share with you in just a minute. Anyway, so first off, and this is what we were talking about on this national show. Subjects like that, you can't get honest responses. It's like religion and sex. Everybody says they go to church a lot and they have sex a lot. In fact, some of these people say, when I'm not going to church, I'm having sex. And there's no way to validate how much sex people are having when what they report. But there is, in terms of religiosity, at least church attendance. I mean, everybody's, oh, I believe in God, sure. Do you believe in hell? Oh, yeah, definitely. And do you have sex a lot? Certainly. It's one of the things I do when I'm not thinking about heaven and hell. But they've done these studies before where they, in small towns where it's easier. So say there's 20,000 people, and I can't do these numbers. So say 10,000 are adults, and 90% of them say they go to church every single Sunday, which a lot of times people do. So that's what, 9,000. And then, so these researchers say, well, how much room is there for people to attend church in the churches in the town? Well, 1,300. So where are the 9,000 people fitting? So anyways, so usually somebody calls you up on the phone, and they call me up on the phone. We're taking a poll. I said, take me off your list. Don't call back. Do you know about that? And my phone's listed under somebody else. So when they say, Mr. So-and-so, I know right away that it's nobody I want to talk to. So before they even get it out of their mouth, I say, take me off your list. Don't call back. Now, those are legal terms. I mean, not specifically, but they, when they're told to not call back and to take you off your their list, they're supposed to. Now you think, well, why would they? Well, one thing they do with the list is they sell them, and they got their little screen there, and when you say something like that, they check hostile, and then they don't sell those. Because why would, because if they start selling bad lists with people that are half hostile hang-ups, well, they're not going to be able to sell them again. So anyway, so I don't even get in the mix. So people call you up and they say, how much do you have sex? Do you go to church frequently? Do you think Jesus is the Son of God? You know, do you, are you happy? I mean, it's ridiculous. I mean, you really have to have sort of deep conversations. On the other hand, I could believe, since the remaining Republicans and conservatives, which is shrinking, fortunately, daily, that they're still in some sort of dreamland of denial about everything's okay, no matter that the slaughter continues in Iraq, the economy for working people, poor people, and a lot of middle-class people is getting worse and worse. The stock market's at an all-time high. So this huge transfer of wealth from the classes below the extraordinarily wealthy up to them. That's how they're getting to be extraordinarily wealthy, the increase of billionaires and all that. Well, they're pretty happy. They're only a small, small little segment of the population. But they have these people, conservatives particularly, that sort of exhibit what's called the concentration camp syndrome. There was a psychologist, Bruno Bettelheim, was he? I think he even was in the concentration camps. And what he says is that one of the ways that people deal with unrelenting aggression, like when you're completely helpless in a concentration camp, is you identify with the guards. So these people, they don't want to identify with their own class, like the working class or the class of poor people or even the middle class. They identify with the interests of those people way above them who they'll never achieve anything like that, and yet they echo the same sentiments. You know, there was a radical union that still exists, the Industrial Workers of the World. You've probably heard me mention this phrase before. They're called the IWW. You can go to IWW.org. That's the kind of unions we should have. And or they were called the Wobblies, which is long story on that as well. And or they weren't wobbly. They were steadfast in fighting for the rights and power of the people. Remember, that's what a populist is. Whenever you hear that phrase, somebody that supports the rights and power of the people. And their preamble to their constitution says the working class and the employing class have nothing in common. You go, well, that's class warfare. Well, hey, the rich are getting richer off the rest of us. So they're practicing class warfare. We complain. We say, oh, drat, our plant is closing. Oh, drat, the overall wages and income of the middle class is shrinking. Oh, drat, Bush is cutting off Medicare for the poor and disabled. How? That's sad. We don't like that. Must be our fault. Well, let me kind of hook a couple of things together here. No, I didn't even finish the thought about happiness. So I think it might be true that people that are middle class, working class, and poor might actually express an unhappiness. I know I'm very unhappy about the state of the world, very frightened about some of it, particularly the environment. And it's a slow rage to know that this illegal, unconstitutional, murderous war based on lies continues in my name, in your name, with our treasury being transferred over to Bush Co., Bush Incorporated, Bush and Sons Incorporated is what one caller told me during the week. I like that. Bush and Sons Incorporated. And so they're making a fortune. Uncle Bucky, you know, one of Bush's uncles, he just made like a cool, I don't know, what was it, several million dollars. Of course, that's, you know, our money. And the economy, all of that. So that makes me very unhappy. I mean, if I ignored everything, things are going pretty well in my life. I'm pretty lucky. I mean, sort of nice that I was born white and middle class kind of gave me a leg up on things. But I've sort of engineered my life, so things have come out all right. But, you know, you never can tell. And that's what has a lot of us anxious and unhappy. because you never can tell. You got a damn good job. You try your hardest. You've honed all your skills. And they come and they say, sorry, your job's going to Mexico. Or sorry, we screwed up big time, so we're cutting loose about 4,000 people, for the white-collar workers. And essentially that means a speed-up. There's going to have much fewer people doing the same amount of work. And it's all very profitable because the stock market is over 11,000. All right, so let's get to two items that, and what we should do right now. I mean, if I had this show like a big staff instead of me and Brandon and Jay Hudson, I'd have music coming up now to be that classic rock Who tune, Won't Get Fooled Again. So tell me you won't get fooled again. You're not going to bite for this anti-immigrant, anti-illegal alien deal. Now, one of the things we were talking about last week were these demonstrations that were much smaller for the third anniversary of Bush's war in Iraq than they had a year previously, even though virtually nobody supports his damn war anymore. I mean, even some of, you know, all these conservatives are peeling off now and saying, whoa, this guy's out of control. We don't want this. His Republican candidates are starting to say, photo op with the president? I don't think so. Anyway, one of the big demonstrations, anti-war demonstrations a year ago, was in part put together by friends of mine in L.A. They brought out 20,000 people. Now, last Saturday in Detroit, there was 300 people. L.A., 20,000 people. That was dwarfed by what occurred, and I think most of you have seen that on the news. More than 500,000 people in Los Angeles demanding that this law that would criminalize illegal immigrants tell anybody that gave him services, like a priest. That's why the National Council of Bishops is against this law. I talked to a psychologist when I was in Caracas. There was a guy I met, really liked him a lot, that said that under this law, that if he gave psychological services to somebody that was in even like potentially involved in spousal abuse, he would be a felon. The psychologist. So hundreds of thousands of people have staged these demonstrations in more than a dozen cities. The one that they've talked the least about is this one in Atlanta, where there was a virtual general strike. Nobody above the level of construction worker or below. Let me see, what would it be? Anyways, all the service jobs didn't show up, and I forgot how many were there. Thousands, thousands and thousands of thousands. Denver, cities in North Carolina. And so here are some of the things they're talking about. Erecting a fence on the Mexican border all the way from Texas to the Pacific. Another great way we can spend our money, right? That's a good idea. But here's what's happening, and here's what I'm telling you not to get fooled again. They're not taking U.S. jobs. The problem with the American economy isn't that there is high unemployment and it's caused by immigrant workers or illegal workers here illegally taking them. The problem is, and who's created this, are the companies that have destroyed our job base, destroyed our industrial base particularly, and hence are destroying our communities. So when they've taken our plants, and beginning again in Detroit, it didn't happen in 1973 with the election of Coleman Young. It happened as early as the middle 50s when these auto plants started thinking, why the hell are we up here paying union wages when we go to the American South that's non-union and pay much cheaper wages? Because they're always trying to buy us for as cheaply as possible. So in order to be competitive with union, a lot of these plants in the South still have to pay decent working-class, middle-class wages. So then they got the bright idea, we can go to Mexico. There's this thin little line called a border, which sort of ends where the U.S. grabbed as much territory as it could back when, was it 1848 or something like that, and pay people 10% of what they have to pay people in Detroit. Standard of living, I'm sorry, not standard, the cost of living is the same. People think, oh, for a dollar, you're rich in Mexico. Not true. Things cost pretty much the same, not completely, but you're not able to live well on $80 a week or whatever in these maquiladores, these factories down there. So this does not come about. Your lack of a job, the fact that the whatever is happening in the economy has nothing to do absolutely nothing to do with the, well, I wouldn't say anything to do. It's part of a whole package. One of the things is, one of the people that are supporting the continuation of immigration are these employers who realize that that it does represent a class of low-paid workers. So the most obvious example, and it's not happened in that many industries, some in construction, particularly in the Southwest, but in the meatpacking industry that almost used to be exclusively white men, it's now been replaced almost exclusively by third-world people. Hispanics, people, oddly enough, in the middle of Nebraska, people from Somalia. And it's part of a whole process of spiraling down, of a race to the bottom. And the people taking those jobs are desperate people. They have the same goals. They're identical to you and I. They're the workers of the world. Remember I was talking about that union, industrial workers of the world. Well, yeah, a lot of us are middle class or white collar, doesn't fit, but essentially it's the same thing. And the ability of employers to play us off one against the other and to scramble for these crumbs, even to kill one another for these crumbs, just plays into their hands. So don't get fooled again. It's not illegal aliens, illegal workers, non-documented workers' fault that this is all going on. In fact, illegal immigrants bring in about $7 billion a year into the Social Security system and are not going to be able to collect a penny of it. You and I will. All right, so then here in the Detroit area, nothing that we can blame on illegal immigrants. The plants are closing, plants moving out of the country, and this is done as a way to save money. Doesn't matter what the hell happens to us. I don't know if you saw that these rags that that run together on Sunday, Detroit News and Detroit Free Press. But here, factory towns fade in Michigan. They're talking about Greenville, Michigan, down towards the Ohio border. Fears of becoming a ghost town mirror worries in other struggling communities. And they're talking about, let's see, three major factories in 15 months have said they're going away. So this is not illegal immigrants' fault. These are the corporations that have our hands in our lives in their hands, and they do what they want with it. And when they totally screw up, if you want to, a lot of people say the GM has made a lot of mistakes. They don't suffer. I mean, have you noticed any of these owners of General Motors, the managers, suffering? Are they losing their jobs for the catastrophic mistakes they've made? Do they move out of West Bloomfield and Grosse Pointe and places like that? I don't think so. It's always the man and woman who's going to work every day in one of their noisy factories, banging out these cars that people don't want to buy to the extent that they used to, and instead want to buy cars that used to be made in Japan, now that are made here. They're doing okay, Toyota and Honda and Kia building this billion-dollar facility. Or in the Georgia and Alabama border, they seem to be able to do it. So why are we, as individuals, and why is are our communities suffering from their mistakes? Now, the only thing more despicable than the way we are treated are these newspapers in Detroit. I've got a couple of editorials here. Oh, man. This one here, and I'm sure it's written by a man who I have nothing but loathing for. I mean, here in a, and why people buy this paper? I mean, here, working class and middle class people buying this these newspapers that have nothing except for the wealthy and the corporations' interest at the center of what they write. This was where's my date on it? March 23rd, a few days ago. Editorial, GM buyouts reduce costs, but more reforms are needed. Reforms. Nolan Finley is the editorial director of the Detroit News and writes a column, I think, every Sunday or something like that. And it's this spectacle of the rich lecturing the working class. The rich telling people the mistakes they've made. They don't control anything. instance, they're always saying that the unions have demanded too much. The companies agreed to it. All right, General Motors' plan to offer early retirement to hourly employees is a humane way to reduce its costs, but the company will need more union cooperation to make its labor costs more competitive. Do I have to explain what that phrase means? It means more spiraling downward. But here, and you can just hear the voice of Nolan Finley here, this unctuous, rich, non-Detroiter. All these people, none of these people live in Detroit. They're always giving advice to Detroit. Anyways, the United Auto Workers should be grateful for this good faith gesture by the world's largest automaker. GM and Delphi could have insisted on harsher measures. So, just, I always see this 19th century factory and this worker coming hunched over with his hat clenched in his hand, you know, those slouch caps, saying, "Thank you, sir. Thank you for not firing me and just cutting my wages in half. We really appreciate that. Thank you, sir." And what's the other one? Oh, yeah. This despicable Thomas Bray. Buyouts reflect high price of Detroit's welfare mentality. Not talking about welfare like we used to know about it, where the poorest were given money so that they wouldn't starve to death or didn't have the poorhouse like they did before this stuff came in the 1930s. But he's talking that the unions wanted a decent wage. The old slogan, what was it? A fair wage for a fair day's work. And that's what it was all about. But the union or the companies made these awful mistakes. The companies made these awful mistakes, and the workers pay for them. And eventually, then you say, "I don't care. I'm not a factory worker. Screw them." Well, it begins to take everything down with it, as we see by what's happening in what's the name of the little town? Greenville? No. Why does that sound wrong? Yeah, Greenville, Michigan. So then the stores start to be affected. They lay off people, and you know the results. And again, Thomas Bray, Nolan Finley, they're always lecturing Detroit. Not a one of them lives here. Why don't they give advice to West Bloomfield? Why don't they give advice to Grosse Pointe? Why don't they give advice to Ann Arbor? That's where they live. All right, I'd like to hear from you. My good mood evaporated, didn't it? 313-298-WRIF is our phone number. I'm Peter Werby. If you'd like to email me, short ones, please, calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Let's take our first caller right now. It's Dan from Wyandotte. Hey, Dan, you're on the air. Dan, did you drop the phone?
Yep. Peter, I don't know where to start with you, sir.
What? What's the matter?
Oh, because you got a Rush baby on right now. And first off, well, I'd like to ask,
are they on tour? I'd like, that's one of my favorite bands.
What, Rush Babies?
No, the band Rush. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, Rush is a good band. Yeah. I like Rush myself.
Yeah, good. So I don't want to talk about rock and roll right now, though.
Okay, well, explain to me how illegal immigrants bring in millions for Social Security, sir.
Billions.
Billions. How do they do that?
Because it's taken out of their paycheck. What do you think? How does it come out of ours?
Most illegal immigrants that I know personally are paid cash, sir.
Well, some of them are, and you know what? So are millions of Americans. So are millions of Americans.
Yeah, but they're 1099 at the end of the year, I believe.
No, they're not. I mean, I know. Listen, do you ever have any work done on your house or anything like that? And I've had guys tell, I shouldn't say, never mind. I know people who have said, look, I want like $500 for this job. Pay me cash. And it'll be $450, and I say, "Oh, okay, but be sure to report it on your income tax." And the guy laughs, right?
Right.
Yeah. So a lot of people are off the books. But let's see here if I can find where this comes from. I don't know. Last year, yeah. Here's an in the country illegally. What's his name? Angel Martinez, and he paid $2,000 towards Social Security, $450 for Medicare through payroll tax withheld from his wages.
Payroll tax. So that means he wasn't getting paid cash. I'd like to know how an illegal immigrant is getting paid through payroll. See, there's something not right about
Well,
that.
I don't know. Maybe so. But, you know, when no one asks me if I'm a citizen or not. But, I mean, I guess they don't suspect that. But they don't ask. People don't ask. That's one of the reasons they want to have that in the bill. But in any event, where are you going with this? I don't understand.
Well, I'm, you know, I sat there and had to listen to you for so long. I mean, I don't know where to start with.
Well, you started there. You weren't going very well so far. But what do you want? What does it say? Communist propaganda here. What's that all?
Well, it is.
You're, what is?
You know, you want to blame it all on big business, and you know. Well, let me ask you something.
Wait. Everybody, you're saying I'm spouting communist propaganda?
Yeah.
All right. Wait a minute. Hold on, Dan. I just want to tell people. Folks, this is not a repeat broadcast from the 1980s or something like this. We're broadcasting live here on March 26th. All right, go ahead. Where is the communist propaganda?
Why?
Well, yeah.
Because you're talking, everybody should be equals. You know, this is a land of opportunity.
Wait. When did I say everyone should be equal?
Well, you're talking about how big business needs to suck up to, you know, just about everybody. You talk about the big three in Michigan specifically.
Yeah.
Talking about taking work down south. There's a reason why they do that.
Well, yeah, they want to make more money. They don't want to pay us decent wages. Are you some rich guy?
Oh, no, sure. I wish I was. But let me ask.
Well, wait a minute. If you're not a rich guy, why are you blowing the trumpet for the ultra rich and the corporations?
Sir, I'll tell you something, because I know what it takes, and bitching and whining and complaining, saying, you know what, I deserve more, isn't what it's all about.
It's not bitching and moaning, but when your job and your lifetime of expectation for pensions and for health care and to reward for the years of service you've given in factories, I think people have a right to bitch and moan, but you're absolutely right, Dan, that's not enough. And we've got to look and around and start figuring out how we can organize and how we can stop this, or all of us are going to be working for Mexico wages. All right, I got to go. Thank you for your call. We'll be right back after these. 313-298-WRIF.
Hear the best rock the Motor City has to offer before they hit it big. Motor City Riff. Every Sunday night at 10. It's loud, it's local, and no friggin' satellite can give you the best local band. Like the station that supports local rock. 101. WRIF, everything that rocks. This is WRIF.com. More Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Hey, thanks a lot. Thanks for joining us. 313-298-WRIF. Talk about commies. Dan from Ypsilanti was talking about communist propaganda. You know, there's this big World Baseball Tournament. What was it? WBC. What the hell? Oh, yeah, the World Baseball Classic. And Cuba came in second. Japan won it. United States lost. Canada lost. Puerto Rico lost, even with all those players on it. Anyways, Cuba's prize money from the first World Baseball Classic has become collateral damage in a four-decade battle between President Fidel Castro and the United States. Castro said he wanted to donate the money that the winnings for coming in second to victims of Hurricane Katrina, but U.S. officials say Cuba isn't getting any prize money. Cuba finished second in the 15-nation competition, and the runner-up was entitled to 7% of the tournament's profits. But under the 1962 U.S. trade embargo, Havana had to forfeit its cut to get U.S. approval to play, even. Castro welcoming Cuba's players home, despite the fact that they lost 10-6 to Japan in the championship game, said the Cuban prize money would be donated to Katrina victims. Oh, man. All right, let's roll on. Here is Jeff in Clinton Township. Hey, Jeff. Hi. Jeff, are you with me?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, go ahead. You're on the air.
Sorry about that.
No problem.
Hey, I don't know where to start.
Neither did Dan.
I guess I got to point out, Thomas Bray and Nick, what's his name, Nolan Finley from the news don't talk about Birmingham or Ann Arbor because they're not the ones having problems. Detroit's having problems. Flint's having problems. And they're having problems because the big three, and I will admit, it's not just labor. You're absolutely right. Corporations have agreed to all the labor contracts that they've done in the past. But the fact of the matter is that labor costs for big three automotive manufacturers are way higher than the rest of the world, and that's why they're going down the tubes.
Well, I don't think that's exactly why they're going down the tubes, but for one thing, ultimately, who's responsible? I mean, I might say, I'll go into my boss tomorrow and say, I want five times my raise, and everyone else does, and if they agree to it, I mean, that's their bad business decision. But what's one of the big, big, big costs embedded in labor?
What's one of the big costs embedded in labor?
Yeah, in the labor costs.
Number one, they're getting paid in the paycheck too much. They're getting paid higher than the market rate for what they do.
Well, see, that's what I mean. When you subject yourself to the market, it is a downward spiral. It is a race to the bottom. Because if we allow our labor to be sold at the way the market directs it, well, hell, we're all going to be working for $2 an hour. Come on, we want to artificially raise the price of our labor in terms of what kind of profitability the overall economy has and the individual enterprises. Well, the big cost, what's the big cost? It's medical, right?
It's a huge part of it.
All right, who pays medical costs in Germany and Japan?
Not the only part of it.
What?
Medical is not the only part of it.
I know, but who pays it?
Who pays what?
Who pays medical costs for workers in Germany and Japan?
Everybody in Germany and Japan does.
Yeah, in other words, the government does through taxation, and they get a medical plan that doesn't have people, tens of millions of people, without it. And it also takes the cost off of the manufacturer. Well, the big three have steadfastly been opposed to the United States joining the rest of the civilized world in providing universal health care for people. So that's another. I mean, they cut their own throats. They're so ideologically wedded to right-wing politics and calling that when the government provides decent care for people, as opposed to spending all our money making war, they're called socialists. All right, thanks a lot. Appreciate your call. 313-298-WRIF. Here is Dan. Dan's in Montrose. All these rock bands tonight. Did Montrose name themselves after your city?
I don't know about that. Well, you know, you're right about this job situation. I mean, we're all losing our jobs fast, and we can count in this state right now.
Yeah.
I mean, a year ago, I was a TIG welder. Now I'm a security guard.
Wow.
I should be at the happiest point in my life. My wife just gave birth to triplets 6 weeks ago.
Oh, boy. Well, congratulations.
Well, I'll worry about keeping food on the table.
Yeah. No, I know. You know what you get, either directly or indirectly from some of these people, it's the worker's fault. It's your fault. It's the fault of the thousands of people that are going to have to, take a buyout of $35,000, which comes out to what after taxes? About $23,000. Some people are working 10 years in a factory diligently. The compassion level is about zero on all conservatives. And the second thing is they don't understand where the root of the problem is. It isn't with the UAW. It isn't with the workers in the plant. Imagine the temerity of these people. They actually want to be rewarded well for spending a lifetime in an auto assembly plant.
Well, it's not even the UAW. We weren't even UAW. We're in a small plant up in Mount Pleasant.
Yeah.
And we were making probably a quarter of what UAW welders make.
Okay.
But we were making a decent enough where I could afford to raise my stepkids and, you know, my wife being pregnant, she didn't have to work and all that. Now, you know, we're getting ready to go to South Carolina as soon as the kids get out of school because I want to be able to know I can put food on the table for them every night.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we shall see. I'm sorry to hear that. I mean, it's this off-told story. Even relatives of mine have been facing that. People said, oh, you got to get into the computers. And so they're computer programmers 10 years ago. That was it. Same thing. Security guard now. Best of luck. And again, congratulations on the birth of your triplets. And we should be, as a family, taking a village to help you raise them and not throwing you out on your own. Thanks, Dan. Appreciate it. 313-298-WRIF. Here is Brian. Brian's in Redford. Go ahead, Brian.
Yeah, how you doing?
Good.
You know, I do construction, and there is a lot of Mexicans out there working under the table doing, brick, cement.
Sure, drywall.
Especially drywall.
Yeah.
You know, I was on a job one time out there in Tor Gypsy, and they must have had 28 of them bricking a house.
Yeah.
And they did that job in one day.
Well, you don't know, too, that it was, were they illegal or not? How do you know?
Well, you know, I just had a funny feeling, you know, some of them were legal and some were just coming and going. But I do know that they get their visas and they get work permits, and a lot of them don't want to go back until they get caught, then they're forced to go back.
Right.
You know?
One of the things that is happening, I don't mean to underestimate it, maybe I was earlier, that, like I said, in the meatpacking industry, where the introduction of immigrant labor, legal immigrant labor, has driven down the wages and benefits in that industry to maybe 25% of what they were 30 or 40 years ago. But that's what's always been done by the employers. Again, it's not these folks. The employers have always used one section of workers against the other. Always.
Well, I think the problem is that the manufacturers have got these goods going up and our wages are going down and people are trying to keep their income that own these businesses at the same level, if not more profitable every year. And they're taking on more low paying.
Yeah. Well, of course, that's the way they think. That's what the first caller said. Well, that's capitalism. You know, that's how you get rich. That's how they got rich.
That's true. But look at when they come through here and they give them all that. You know, they give them medical when they put them in here. They do the AMC program. I mean, how many do you take in before, you know, people that were raised here and low income people are out here, you know, roughing it? You know, come on.
Listen. I'm telling you, there's not high unemployment in the country. Michigan's higher. And
right, it's just that, you know, yeah, I know that. It's because we're a Democrat state.
Yeah. Yeah. What, do you think that's why we have higher unemployment?
That's what I hear from the elderly people.
From the what people?
From the elderly people.
The elderly people.
You know, people have been around for, you know, our elders.
Yeah, well.
I'm like 40, you know, I talk.
Elders can be wrong. I don't. That's a statement that makes absolutely no sense whatsoever.
In there, and you're a Democrat state. They're not going to support you all the way with that government money they ship to the state.
Well, yeah, we are a donor state. What that means is what we pay to the federal government, we don't get that much back. See, what should happen in a government that's not a racket, like the federal government is now, is that it collects taxes from all of us and then it redistributes it to, in particularly in services. But, of course, what happens is the majority, I don't know what percentage, but, yeah, I think over half of it goes to war and war industries, to Bush's buddies, to destroy Iraq, then to rebuild Iraq, and on like that. So some of the states that they favor, for instance, like Georgia, that has a lot of weapons manufacturing and what have you, that's where our dollars go. So when you look at your paycheck, Brian, and 25% or a third is gone, it's not like you're getting back something like we were saying, universal health care, great roads, great schools. It's going to corporations that support Bush to fight against Iraq and, you know, the mess that it is. So it's a racket. We're actually getting looted. It happens on lots of levels. All right. Thanks a lot. Appreciate your call. Let's see. Here is Hank. Hank's in Ypsilanti. Hi, Hank.
Hey, how's it going?
Going good.
I was just kind of listening and kind of steaming a little bit because, I mean, it's not really, you know, just big business's fault. It's not just the UAW's fault or the workers' fault. I think it's kind of all our fault because it's like the basic thing that, like, really has a stranglehold on, like, most of Michigan is the auto industry. And it really is, like, it's starting to go down. I mean, it's the American auto industry, the big three, really, that has a stranglehold on Michigan. And it's going down because of the gas prices being what they are. And, like, what the big three usually make is, you know, V8s and V6s and the high gas using vehicles, which are only really used by, you know, the upper middle class and the upper class, you know. And so there's not a huge market for it anymore. And that's
why I don't understand why this is anybody's fault other than marketing decisions by the brainy guys in suits at the General Motors building.
That's true. I mean, it's their fault for, you know, not having the foresight to go and invest money into, you know, economy cars and that kind of thing, and that's why their business is tanking. But
yeah, I mean, everybody I know that works in auto, that are UAW members, they work their butts off, and they have no decision input into what is made whatsoever. They say, make Cadillac Escalade SUVs, which my wife today, she said, what the hell is that? And I said, it's a Cadillac SUV. And she says, it looks like one of those tow trucks. I said, yeah, well, it does. So the workers didn't have anything to do with this. They're out there busting their butt. And you always get these rich guys that live, that write for the newspapers that live in Grosse Pointe and Birmingham and Ann Arbor. And they're always talking about, in fact, one of them, I thought one of these editorials actually said at the end of it some slimy little remark about how people just don't work very hard. Still intact is the creaky labor structure that makes a virtue of inefficiency on the factory floor. Yeah, right. You know, these guys, the most labor they've ever done is, go out to get their paper every morning. All right. Thanks a lot. Appreciate your call. 313-298-WRIF. Peter Werbe here with you. Call talkyes@yahoo.com. You know, I always have, as anybody that's gone to my website knows, political stuff. I mean, that's what the show's about. That's what we're supposed to be talking about. This is a public affairs show, so we're not going to talk about rock and roll or, I don't know, fashion or anything like that. But I saw this. Let me give you my website in case you don't know it. Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E, W-E-R-B-E, peterwerbe.com. And I put on there a video of a guy juggling. You go, a guy juggling? I mean, for one thing, what does it have to do with anything that we talk about or that what is on the website? And juggling? So what? Who cares? This is the most extraordinary human activity I've seen in a while. It really just talks up to me about balance and harmony. Actually, my Tai Chi teacher sent it to me, and she has the discipline of Tai Chi Chuan. It's about balance and harmony. So check that out. It just talk about feeling good or bad. It made me feel real good. It may have the same effect on you. All right, here is Andy. Andy is in Canton. Hi, Andy. It's Peter Werbe. You're on the air.
Hey, Peter. How you doing?
Doing good. Thanks for calling.
just want to say I really appreciate your show. Every time I can get a chance to hear it, I definitely do.
Good. Thanks.
One thing I just wanted to bring up real quick is, I don't know if you remember this, but about, I think it was probably 4 years ago, but definitely earlier in Bush's administration, he kind of waffled a little bit on this immigration issue. In fact, what he was saying was that there are certain jobs that are in America that are undesirable by the American citizens. And because we just don't want them because they're dirty jobs and they don't pay well anyways, we should just allow the illegal immigrants to do them.
Mm-hmm.
And now it seems that, you know, he kind of is switching back over, not, you know, a couple years later, and he's saying, well, we need these immigrants out of here so much that we need to erect walls to keep them out.
Yeah, maybe we can get
kind of silly.
Yeah, maybe we get the Israeli Defense Force. They got a wall like that between Palestine and Israel. Maybe we get them to patrol it.
That worked very well for them.
Yeah, yeah. Well, listen, as I was saying, and one of our callers was talking about construction, there in certain industries, new immigrants frequently over the last 150 years have acted as a way to bid down labor because of excessive labor prices. For instance, one of the ways that African Americans were manipulated and whites were actually manipulated into racist response was that blacks would be kept out of jobs, kept out of industries, never hired, but then they would be used as strike breakers. So this all white union that sometimes 1940s, 1950s, unions that would not allow black members in it, they would go out and strike, and then these companies suddenly would say, we're giving equal opportunity to blacks, or Negroes, as they were called at the time. And so suddenly, here would come a workforce of African Americans ready to work, and they would think, screw these white guys. They always tried to screw us and keep us out of jobs. And, of course, the white unions would say, we hate those people because they're breaking our strike. So what's happening? It turns into a cockroach war. And I'm sorry, I don't mean to be disparaging about anybody involved. But in the sense, scurrying around for the crumbs that are falling off the table of the rich people that are manipulating all of us, that instead of understanding where the source of misery and insecurity and low wages and no benefits come from, turn on each other. They turn on each other.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because that kind of bleeds into the other thing that I wanted to mention about what it is to be a populist. Just 2 days ago, I received an email about Mr. Chavez, the villain, over in Venezuela, and how horrible he was, and how he was calling for the American empire to be shut down. And as a result, we good fellow Americans need to, in an effort of solidarity, get together, and whatever we do, don't buy gas from Citgo, because that's the Venezuelan, you know, extension.
Right.
And because this guy associates with who President Bush calls, and of course he's, you know, such a great guy to quote because he's so reliable in his sources and his information, but he calls him the biggest terrorist in the world. Mm-hmm. So apparently we've been hunting for different guys, you know, not the big terrorists. We've just been going after Osama and Saddam.
Well, I always
but we've been missing them.
I always buy at Citgo gas. For one thing, it supports Americans. Maybe the money goes to Venezuela, but the money that now goes from the Venezuelan National Oil Company doesn't go to line the pockets of the wealthy small elite of Venezuela.
It's terrorists, as the email.
Yeah, well, that's nonsense. It's used extensively for programs for the horribly, horribly poor. In fact, Chavez, since coming in, has reduced poverty in Venezuela 20%. As you may know from listening, I was in Venezuela at the end of January, and I have my own criticisms of Chavez that mostly come from the left, not from the right, certainly. But in terms of dealing with poverty and a basis of capitalism, I mean, he talks about 21st century socialism, but he's invested in the world market. He wants gas and oil pipelines. He's building big, huge super ports and having capital investment from other countries. And also, one of the things that the prophets have done is to help poor people in the United States, because Citgo is donating oil and home heating oil at a discount to poor Americans in the Northeast. So anybody that tells you, hey, don't buy it because it's helping Chavez, it's not like he's going to buy another castle or something like that. Man, these conservatives, what a piece of work. All right, I got to go. Be right back after these. 313-298-WRIF.
How are you doing?
Delivered fresh. You want our Riff Rock?
Yummy.
Just for you. Whoa. On the Riff.
Yes, yes, get on with it.
101-WRIF has the latest riffs from Godsmack, Rob Zombie, David Gilmour, Pink Floyd, and Kid Rock.
You can do this now. Come on.
When I'm hot off the grill?
Yeah, hell, I'm starving.
Before anyone else in town?
Don't wait until it hurts.
Then keep it on 101 The Riff all year long. With the freshest riffs from fans like Red Hot Chili Peppers, Jets, Linkin Park, Pearl Jam, Tool, and Metallica.
You are worth it.
We bring you the latest riff you want.
You're welcome.
101 WRIF. Everything.
Yeah!
That it rocks.
Rocks.
This is WRIF.com.
Hanging around downtown by myself, and I had so much time to sit down and think about myself, and then there she was, like double cherry pie. Yeah, there she was, like disco superfly. I smell sex and candy hair. Who's that lounging in my chair? Who's that casting devious stares in my direction? Mama, this surely is a dream. Yeah. Yeah, mama, this surely is a dream. Dig it. Caffeine, and I was thinking about myself, and then there she was, in platform double suede. Yeah, there she was, like disco lemonade. Yeah. I smell sex and candlelit hair. Who's that lounging in my chair? Who's that casting devious stares in my direction? Mama, this surely is a dream. Yeah. Yeah, mama, this surely is a dream. Yeah, yeah, mama, this surely is a dream. Yeah. I smell sex and candy hair. Who's that lounging in my chair? Who's that casting devious stares in my direction? Mama, this surely is a dream. Dig it. Yeah, mama, this surely.
WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
All right, thanks a lot. Welcome back to our second hour. At 1 a.m., we'll be doing a couple of interesting universes. That's an interesting slip. Interviews. One with a pal of mine who's written the definitive tour book of Cuba, Christopher Baker. about classic cars. And you think, well, again, what does this have to do with politics? Yeah, it's interesting. Check out Chris. And also an interview about the economy as well. Now, a couple of emails here that I think are worth juxtaposing. Brian from Taylor writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. I normally agree with your opinions, but I strongly disagree with your criticism of Michigan executives, such as those at the U.S. automakers. Yeah, Brian, they're doing great. They've made a lot of great decisions. That's why they're in such good shape. Well, here, according to Brian, I think that the demands of union labor are crushing the American auto workers, the big three, and are slowly bringing down the state of Michigan. I'm a young computer programmer, not an automaker, working on and paying for my second college degree. Now, get this language. Get this language, folks. Herein lies the prejudices that turn so many people's brains around who should be showing solidarity with their fellow middle class and working class people, and instead they say what the wealthy executives want them to say. Here's what he says. Let me go back to this. Brian, I'm really surprised. And anyway, where is this? He says, I'm a young computer programmer working on my second college degree, yet a lazy UAW janitor makes about as much money as I do and gets much better benefits to boot. A lazy UAW janitor. So it demeans a crucial part of work in any plant. I mean, why didn't he say a tool and die maker or a assembly line worker or somebody in a paint shop or something like that? It's a janitor. The lowest of the low of the working class. Of course, as I always say, if there's going to be a general strike, who would you rather didn't work, a janitor or a lawyer? We get along without lawyers. Sorry to all my friends that are lawyers, but janitors are pretty key to things, right? And everything's a team. Everything is a joint effort, and janitors are a crucial part of it. So it's the lazy. Here's the stereotype. I mean, it's like saying the welfare queens. This is what the Republicans were successfully put in the minds of so many working people to give them prejudices against the poor. Don't fall for this, Brian. In fact, here's another email from Terry who wrote into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. For one thing, people work, and they work hard. And you know what? Marx said, workers of the world unite. My slogan is, workers of the world relax. Why the hell should we have to absolutely break our butt every second? But anyways, there's all these job categories have job definitions, and they have to make, he's like, I worked at a plant, and I knew a guy who used to sleep up on the racks all the time, never did a bit of work. Yeah, I know. You know, there's people that screw off all the time. In the meantime, these companies were making lots of money. And the reason they didn't is because of their decisions, not because of a, quote, lazy UAW janitor. Damn. And everybody else, I work hard. And you know what it is, too? And you can get it in there that yet a lazy UAW janitor makes about as much money as I do and gets much better benefits to boot. It's called the politics of resentment. Rather than understanding, this is all going to probably go down the drain, by the way, but rather than understanding is that overall, union labor gets better pay, better benefits, more days off, and all of that. In a country that has some of the worst wages, the worst benefits, and the least days off, and saying, man, this is a model for how I would like to be able to be rewarded. They're lazy UAW janitors, and they get better benefits. Rather than wanting to emulate those benefits, which should be due to everyone as a matter of right, the world does owe us a living. Or screw the world, or the world that they've created for us. We didn't create this world of work and war. They did. The upper classes, the wealthy, the rich, the ruling classes, this is their world. And they've made a total mess of it. They've made a total mess of it. Look around the world. Well, it's very nice out in my little suburb. Yeah, well, open your eyes. Look at Iraq. Look at Africa. Look at Asia. Anyway, here's what Terry writes. I'm blessed enough to be an auto worker. We were given certain data regarding the cost of an automobile. The cost of labor and management is 18% of the cost of a vehicle. Advertising is 36%. The people bitching about our pay should know that. Tell them to consider that when they are watching their favorite TV show or sports team. Also, according to a study by the Department of Labor, that's run by a guy named George W. Bush, the work that average auto worker does is worth an estimated $475,000. The problem is with management, and they're trying to drive down the cost of labor so they can make more and more money. I mean, in fact, that some of these corporations, I mean, what is this? The economy is at over 11,000 on the Dow Jones stock average. Who's making all this money? Doesn't appear to be Delphi. Doesn't appear to be General Motors. Doesn't appear to be the airlines. Why can't these people operate in a manner that every other big corporation is that is making money? So don't put it off on the workers. It's really unseemly. All right, let's take another call. Here is Matt. Matt's in Sterling Heights. Hi, Matt.
How you doing?
Good.
Good show.
Thanks.
Hey, I have a question for you.
Sure.
What do you think the compensation or, well, let's just stick with compensation. What do you think the compensation of a automotive or manufacturing laborer should be?
Well, I don't think there's a fixed figure, but it used to be that productivity was tied in. That was like the big post-World War II deal, is that there was a certain wage that made sense. I mean, you know, look, there could be a period in which a, and that's what the UAW is doing. They're cooperating with General Motors and Delphi. But it should be tied to increased productivity, which increases profitability for the firm. But that's long gone away. So workers in this society, in our country, are producing more and more. Their productivity is rising, and but our wages aren't. So in other words, all that money that we're producing by our labor is just taken by the ultra-rich and the corporations.
Okay, so if a person, say, down in Alabama or Georgia is doing the same amount for less, is that wrong?
I mean, the person...
It's not wrong for the person to do it. No. If a laborer walks into, say, Honda or Toyota and says, yeah, I am willing to work for $17 an hour rather than the $28 up in Michigan.
Is that wrong?
I'm happy to not have a union. Right? I'm maybe happy to not have the benefits that the union and GM or whatever may provide. Is that wrong?
What do you mean wrong? I don't even know what you mean wrong. Stupid. It's stupid, but it's not wrong.
Why is it stupid?
Well, because as I said, and as you just said, you get better benefit. Is it wrong for a man to walk into a Maquiladora's Ford plant in Sonora, in the state of Sonora, and say, I'll work for $2 an hour and I don't want a union? No, that's all that we can get. And when someone now, when the UAW goes bankrupt and there is no more auto union as well, and when they decide, hey, we're going to, like Delphi said, we're going to cut your wages in half. And people will walk in and they'll say, I'm willing to work in an auto plant for $14 an hour and no benefits. Is that wrong? No, but that's not what's at issue. Wrong. I don't even understand what you mean.
Well, because you make it sound like that if a person doesn't belong to a union and they're not working for the union wage, they're an ignorant person.
No, it's not that. I think that people that refuse, there are some really good reasons why people don't belong to unions. I mean, I don't think unions are what they used to be. Part of the problem that the unions find themselves in is of their own making. I used to work for the United Auto Workers. I mean, I saw this close up. I'm not their biggest fans, to tell you the truth. But, I mean, what they've lost is the edge of militancy that made them, that made them and made the companies kicking and screaming who brought in goons and cops and National Guard and whatever to stop them from unionizing, finally pay our grandfathers and fathers, decent wages and set the wage standard. That's what labor unions do as well. They set the wage standard. You go to a place where there's, no unions or unions have no power and, everybody's wages are crap. And that's what's going to happen again here. Okay. Thanks a lot. I appreciate you bringing that up. Good point, whatever it was. Here's Derek. Derek's in Huntington Woods. Hi, Derek.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
Good, good. Hey, yeah, I just had a question. I've been listening to you. I'm actually on the way home from the airport. I'm a white-collar worker.
No, that's it.
And it's interesting because I lost my job to the Chinese labor market.
Uh-huh.
And actually, I trained my replacement. And have you been to China? Have you been to Shanghai?
I've never been to China, no.
Well, you know what? You should go.
Why?
Because the Chinese are fantastic workers. They work very hard. And in Shanghai, it's probably comparable to, well, Shanghai is like New York City. But so the average wage is fairly high. But it's just kind of interesting, you know, because the U.S. or the U.S. economy within the next, I would say, 10 years will probably, you know, continue to decrease as the Chinese pick up, and that's all our doing. I mean, it's all our doing. It's how hard we work. It's what we do, and that's it.
Okay. Drive safely. You shouldn't be driving while here. Talking and driving anyways, but I appreciate it, Derek. Good luck on getting a job as well. I'm going to go a little out of order and get someone who's been waiting a long time. It's Matthew in Harbor Beach. Hey, Matthew, where is Harbor Beach? Is that up near Mount Clemens?
Yeah, that's up in the thumb of Michigan.
Okay.
The tip of the thumb.
What's up?
Well, first I'd like to say that my dad is actually an auto worker. He works for Daimler Chrysler. He is the definition of hardworking. He drives from Harbor Beach to Detroit, 2 hours one way just to go to work. So, you know, he's hardworking.
Mm-hmm.
He's been doing that for so many years. But that's beside my point. I've been reading a book. Well, let me first tell you, I'm a college student. I'm 21 years of age, so you can kind of see why I talk in layman terms a little bit.
Okay.
But I've been reading a book by Thomas Friedman called The World is Flat.
Right. It's one of the New York Times bestseller. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's given me a lot of questions, and a lot of what you're saying today really applies to a lot of that.
Uh-huh.
How these jobs around here are going to outsourcing and offshoring and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And it makes me think about it, and I think that what's going to happen is more or less the Chinese market, Indian market, all that stuff, they're going to get so much stronger, but then America's going to start going downhill, really downhill. Well, because of what we're doing right now is all these corporations, they're doing short-term fixes.
Mm-hmm.
And they're looking at the short-term profit they're getting, but in the long run, they don't see what it does to the economy. They just see what it does to their pocketbook.
Well, I don't know that they're indistinguishable because one of the things with the world market, people say, well, gee, if, like in Greenville, Michigan, we were talking about if businesses close and the town turns into a ghost town, who's going to buy things? Well, if you have a world market for almost every product, you can have the model of, say, Mexico or Guatemala universalized across the planet. So you have this third of the population that has what we used to call decent middle-class wages and most of the money going to the top 5% or 1%, which things are on its way to that right now, as you see, like the middle class is losing wealth, overall average pay in the working class is dropping, the poor are increasing, all the signs of the Guatemalization of the United States. So you can still have these enclaves of where middle class standards remain and privilege like that remains, and the bottom two-thirds, well, hey, it's their fault, they should have been retrained, maybe we can become a call center for Chinese corporations or something like that. Thank you, Matthew, and I'm sure your father is hardworking if he works in an auto plant. Let's make our program international and go to Jeff in Windsor. Hi, Jeff. It's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Hello, Pete.
Hi.
I haven't called in for like many years, and I've been putting off for so long, but I guess tonight's main top just kind of got my dander up.
How come?
I don't know where to start. That's been the common
yeah.
thing with a couple of these
right.
guys. I'm an auto worker in Windsor. I work at Daimler Chrysler Plant 3. And I wonder if these people complaining about my wages and that one guy who said, well, is it wrong for me to take lower wages in the South? I wonder if it's occurred to any of these people that
the reason that they people are happy to take those, or the reason that corporations are happy to pay those, there's pretty good wages in the South, not bad. Like, I mean, but I wonder if it's occurred to them the reason corporations in the South pay as much as they do is that so they won't get a union in.
Sure. No, that's actually the case. I mean, they want to be competitive with their salary structures. And what's happened when the UAW's tried to, and unsuccessfully tried to unionize, Mercedes and, Toyota and Honda, the wage structures have been very close. And of course that the unions, or not, I'm sorry, the companies, and what they always do to stop unionization is they fire people that are the leadership of the unionization. They either directly or by whisper campaign saying, well, if this unionizes, we might just have to go somewhere where there is no unions. So out of fear, I mean, that's who's ascendant right now. Capital is ascendant, not the workers. It's been different at different times. Or you have a situation that's mitigated by the political state, like in a lot of European countries, where they say, hey, you've got to pay a decent wage. It's $12 an hour minimum wage. You have 30 days paid vacation. You have 30 days for both husband and wife, or for father and mother. That is maternity and paternity leave. That's guaranteed in some of the European countries, although as they begin to face the competition from globalization and the world market, there's even that is beginning to erode. So that's what we're facing. And people can call in forever and say, oh, it's the workers because they want more money. And that's not going to stop. And like maybe
I hear it all the time.
Yeah, maybe they'll get to be in the one-third that maintains the old standard of living that our parents had and some of us have. But you know what? I don't want to work against 2-to-1 odds. That's not good. That's, well, it's better odds than your casino over there, isn't it, or the ones here?
No. Well, the thing that I have to laugh about is, well, that one college student computer programmer talked about lazy UAW janitors, and he makes so much more than I do. I wonder if any, and there's plenty of people who think like that, but I wonder if any of them have contemplated the irony of that sentiment when they, like, isn't that a communist sentiment? I mean, think about it.
Well,
I mean, especially when you had your first caller and the communist propaganda. I mean, I wonder if it's actually occurred to any of these guys. You know, I want the auto workers to make less because they make too much more than I do.
Yeah, no, well, that's what I said. It's the politics of resentment rather than than understanding that there's leadership there that should be emulated. And when you think about it, like when people would talk about welfare queens, remember that was the Reagan slogan in the 1980s that turned people against poor people. And if you ever ask them, how many welfare queens do you think there are? And they go, what? I mean, I used to ask them this on this show. I said, you didn't hear my question? And they said, I said, how many welfare queens do you think there are? Is there a dozen? Are there hundreds? Are there thousands? Are there hundreds of thousands? And I'd say, hello, you got to answer me. This is radio, not television. You can't look pensively. Because what it is really, just like the lazy janitor image, that's exactly what it is. It's an image projected by the people that stand to gain from that kind of view. And here are these people in the working class, in the middle class, having these ideas planted in their heads by the people that have no interest in their interest whatsoever. I can't believe people are this dumb.
No, you nailed it earlier. The Stockholm syndrome. It's I hear it all the time, and like I say, it gets thrown my way more often by people who know me when they know what my wage is and all that, what my benefits are. I mean, let's face it, it's no secret.
Well, also, how does he know whether any UAW janitors are lazy? And I've had people call up and say, I've worked in factories; these guys do nothing. I said, well, how the hell do they get cars out, or how do they? How do they keep the place clean or what have you? And a lot of these people, of course, like obviously that Brian, he never worked in an auto plant. How does he know what it's like? I'll tell you, like I say, a lot of my friends have worked in plants. Some of them still do. And toured some of them when they were available. And you guys are making about 10% of what you should be making.
Oh, hey,
to do that every day.
Well, the funny thing is, I would have said the same thing he did back before I started working there.
And I saw the light within a few months. I was like, okay, I totally understand. And my whole worldview's changed too. Like, I mean, like, it's like you said, politics of resentment. And, you know, because we actually have the force to fight for decent wages. And when enough corporations, enough companies end up saying, well, screw you, we're going to go to Mexico, we're going to go to China. I mean, a lot of these people like that, Brian, the computer programmer kid, whose computers is he going to reprogram? Who's going to be able to afford to buy these computers?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, well, you know what happens, too. If, like, what is top of the line Ford? What are these? What are those Fords now? They 500? Isn't there a Ford 500 or something like that?
Don't know about 400 or 500. Chrysler 300, I'd
love anyway, but there's some. I think they got Fords now are like $28,000.
Mm-hmm.
40 years ago, a Cadillac cost $4,000, right?
And you figure in the inflation.
Yeah, so they have probably, figuring in inflation, they've probably gone up two or three times, and people's wages have not gone up. So how do you do that? Well, again, you have a sector of the population that's well-waged enough to purchase these things. So it's kind of like the airlines. You have less flights, less employees, less equipment, and higher prices, so it all works out. All right, I got to move on, Jeff. Thanks for making our show international.
Thank you, Pete.
Appreciate it. For those of you listening far away, Windsor, Ontario, is about 8 miles, if you're ready for this, to the south of Detroit. The south of Detroit. There's this Journey song in which they sing, I was born in South Detroit, which is kind of a running joke with Detroiters, because South Detroit is Windsor. There is no South Detroit. And you go, how could it be south of it? How can Canada be south of Detroit? Check your map. All right. 313-298-WRIF. I'm Peter Werby. Hi, this is Gary in Flint, the scene of the crime. Hi.
How you doing?
Doing good.
Hey, I'm just calling to tell you, this is an interesting topic for me, because I know people on both sides of the General Motors. My brother-in-law's real high up in management. My father's works as a test engineer, but a lot of my real good friends are, they're line workers, and a few of them are skilled trades workers.
Uh-huh.
And it just seems to me that there needs to be a little bit more compromise between the two. My brother-in-law tries to look at it from both perspectives, and I have a lot of respect for him. He's not one of the managers that says, oh, it's all the UAW's fault, you know, but some of their fault, some the manager's fault, but he basically blames most of it on directly to the managers. First, mm-hmm. The managers have the problem, and then yes, there is a little, in some cases, I'm not sure every plant, but there is some, you know, taking advantage of their position.
Well, everybody does that everywhere, but Gary, I suspect that when you say you have relatives or friends that are in management, none of them are in a very, very high management.
Well, I wouldn't say
they're not making big decisions.
Well, they're building a new plant in Lansing right now.
Yeah.
And I don't know exactly what my brother-in-law's job title is, but he's pretty much in charge of building that new plant. And it just comparing that plant, cause that's how I can get the information from him, just in conversations like this, to the truck and bus plant in Flint, which, God bless it, I bought my truck. You know, my truck is made there. I think it's great. I love Flint. I love General Motors. But, I mean, it seems to me like there's – like, I have friends that don't sleep much at home because they sleep at work. And they go fishing all the time because, they never take a day off because they feel like they should, you know, they're making so much money mm-hmm. as a skilled tradesman that, you know, why should I take a day off? I mean, you know. I'm sure
I hear stories from time to time about that. That just means in terms of the job specifications. The UAW Big Three contracts, the job, I don't know, is it job definition section or something like that? Very, 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 very detailed, very, very long, so that everyone has very specific work. And if the UAW, if the workers represented by the UAW have certain tasks to complete, and if people are goofing off on the job, I mean, that's a supervision problem. All right, thanks a lot. I appreciate it. John's in Newport. John, hi. It's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Hey, Peter. How you doing?
Doing good.
Well, I was originally talking. I was going to talk to you about how it just seems I heard you talk about, I think it was you that went to Caracas. Is that true?
Yeah.
And it just seems like everybody that goes against OPEC is a terrorist.
Right.
I mean, you know what I mean? I mean, the reason they took Saddam out, I mean, I don't understand the economics behind it, but he wanted to go from the dollar to the euro or
yeah,
something.
Yeah, that was enough to finish him off. And Chavez has been talking about the same thing, I think, just to screw around with Bush, who he calls a drunkard and a donkey. Why is he messing? I mean, this guy's got a big army. I guess they're not going to invade Venezuela, though. My wife, when I went, she was afraid. What if they invade while you're there? I said, man, they can't even beat an irregular force of guerrillas, insurgents. They're not going to.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, because the armies in Venezuela is pretty big.
I was just listening to, like you're talking about the UAW. A lot of my family's in the UAW. I worked for a steel manufacturer.
Uh-huh.
And I can tell you what happens a lot of times, and it's not the major percentage of it, but there was a lot of people in the skilled trades industry, like millwrights and what have you, and we have like these little break areas where we rest or when it's cold and when it's time we clean them up. And these guys would come in and sit in there and they would sleep for 8 hours on the clock or 16 if they were working a double. And I used to look at them and I'd say, look, you know, I mean, I'm not here to tell you what to do. I said, but the people that run companies now are not like, they don't hire within. They hire all the accountants, these young kids, and they're, I call them bean counters. And
right.
Basically, at the shareholders meeting, what they do is look in the lower right-hand corner, and that number's got to be a specific number. And I said, they're going to get, you know, they give you a job that takes, let's say, 120 hours, 240 hours, but it's taking you 800 hours.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to look at that and say, hey, wait a minute, something ain't right. And I said, what they're going to do is they're going to bring in contractors. And then everybody's going to complain that the contractors are taking the, you know, the regular union jobs away. And that's exactly what happened.
Well, you know, I tell you, doing this show for so many years, I have heard over the years so many tales of what, to the point where I suspect that they have validity to them, that there are people that are, quote, lazy in all sorts of positions that can goof off that, I mean, somehow none of the people that I know are able to find those jobs. Everyone I know works in the plants complains about the pace of the work, and you know, maybe they should talk to, you know, some friends. But anyways, it's like that somehow that the lazy workers are bear responsibility for the predicament that these auto companies have put themselves in. And somehow that all the other auto companies in the world have non-lazy employees and ones that aren't able to sleep 8 hours. But I don't know. I mean, I've heard these tales when the companies were very profitable. So I would suspect that inefficiency on the part of the workforce is not an item at all. Although, like I say, I hear this all the time. All right, thanks a lot. I appreciate it. I mean, this is really in the realm of urban myth. Like I say, I mean, I knew people that when they worked in the plants, they had what they called a groove room. Can you imagine that? And they would take, in fact, they had set it up. It actually got blown away when the UAW and Chrysler went on a big campaign against drinking and getting high on the job. But they created this groove room where they took floor mats and, you know, made kind of a psychedelic little deal. And they would go in there and drink and get high. And what their deal was, what they were told, just get the production up. So they had certain production levels that everyone met. And also, you know, how many guys were like working at Dodge Truck then? I don't know, a few thousand. This was a little room. So the story of men and as it came to be women going into Dodge Main and or Dodge Truck and kicking out the production, the vast numbers of them did just that. They went to work every day. No story there. You have a story about people that would come in with a day's supply of joints and head out to the groove room and hang out and smoke and get smoked out and all of that. That's an interesting story. That's one that people repeat. But you know what? That groove room, from the description of my pals, was pretty small. So there wasn't however many people that were there. So the image is, though, you have thousands of Chrysler UAW workers getting high and doing no work. Well, that was a period in which was pretty high profitability. Then they made a lot of mistakes in product and what have you. So it I mean, blaming this on the workers is really the worst explanation imaginable. And you know what? It all is at the level of mythology, because there isn't a single analyst that either from labor or from management or independent that says the reason that the auto companies are doing poorly is because of worker inefficiency or laziness, whatever the hell that means, on the part of workers. It's total BS. It's total BS. I'm not saying that there's not people that sleep on the job. There's people that don't do much work. There's people that aren't lazy. Of course there are. You could talk to one of our bosses here, and he'd probably say, yeah, I know there's people that screw off half the day here. I don't know. I don't know anybody that does that here, actually. Everybody works pretty hard. I better say that to get myself out of trouble. But that's not a problem. That's not a problem enunciated other than the people that foolishly, absolutely foolishly, take the side of management against their own. And they do the work of the employers in stopping the solidarity that's necessary to, if we're going to save our standard of living. For one thing. All right, let me take a break and I'll be right back and get your calls. 313-298-WRIF. This is, well, the man will tell you.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
More Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much. This is our final segment right up till 1 a.m. Eastern Time. And then a couple of interviews. I can't remember who they were. Chris Baker talking about classic cars in Cuba. A lot more going on, though, as well. I wonder, you know what? Actually, this is a repeat. I think it was from like 04. And I went to Cuba in February. When was it? February of 05. Right. So this is before I went. Actually, it was Chris Baker's book. In fact, look him up if you're interested. Christopher Baker, and the tour book is called Cuba. Absolutely amazing. Anyways, let's see here. It is Joe. Joe writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Just a reminder, the hash bash. I forgot all about that. Oh, man. So let me see. Was this 26? I mean, yeah, we're not going to. I always play the song, Hash Bash, and I don't forgot about it. It's April 1st. Last time I was at a hash bash, it was with Drew and Mike, our morning crew here in at WRIF, and the whole gang went out there. Trudy, and we met all the High Times people. That's a magazine. Anyway, the Hash Bash is Saturday, April 1st, the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, 12 noon high. He's going to be there with NORML, National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws. Hope to see you. Man, I might be there. And Joe says, doing my part to piss off the religious right. That's always a good time. But let me warn all of you, as usual, that are going out there, particularly oftentimes I find this with younger people, like teens, and they think, oh, yeah, Ann Arbor, it's cool. We can just go smoke weed there because it's legal in Ann Arbor. It's not legal in Ann Arbor, number one. It's a small misdemeanor in the city for which you can be fined, but if you are on the University of Michigan property, you can be arrested under either a high misdemeanor or even felony statutes. So don't be going to the hash bash and smoking weed, or you could easily pay the price for it. All right, let's see. This is too... let me see. This is from a skilled trades woman who calls herself Rizpa. I'm a skilled trades woman that works for GM. Let me clear up this mess that people are putting on the air. The reason a person from skilled trades would sit or rest is the machines are running. The job of a skilled trades person was to keep the machines running. I will say, as a boss once said to me, I like it when you are sitting because that means the machines are running. If the machines are running, then productivity is up. If a machine is down, we're busting our butts to get the machines running so the car or parts can get made. All right, there's a lot more to it. Eric's listening in Iowa City, Iowa. He writes in, the problem is that people saying that other people are making too much money are usually the ones that claim that they are not making enough. Instead of figuring out how to lift everyone, they try and knock down everyone else. The classic bully syndrome. Aldous says, oh, this is about the Journey song. What Journey song? I'm not a real expert on Journey. I'm not into step on any toes, but it's not my favorite band. They do some things that are okay. They've sold jillions. I mean, they're up near the Beatles in terms of total sales. Aldous writes in, I always figured that poor Journey or their songwriters didn't know the term downriver, so they made their South Detroit mistake. Wouldn't it have been funny to have it been East Detroit, especially since it's now East Point. All right. Oh, yeah. We haven't bashed Bush very much tonight, our usual fare. This is what you need to be a conservative. This is what you need to be a conservative. This is what you need to believe to be a conservative. That Jesus loves you and shares your hatred of homosexuals and Hillary Clinton. In order to be a conservative, you need to believe that Saddam was a good guy when Reagan armed him, a bad guy when Bush's daddy made war on him, a good guy when Cheney did business with him, and a bad guy when Bush needed a we-can't-find-bin-Laden diversion. In order to be a conservative, you have to believe that trade with Cuba is wrong because the country is communist, but trade with China and Vietnam is vital to the spirit of international harmony. You have to believe that the United States should get out of the United Nations, and our highest priority is enforcing United Nations resolutions against Iraq. To be a conservative, you have to believe that a woman can't be trusted with decisions about her own body, but multinational corporations can make decisions affecting all mankind without regulation. You have to believe the best way to improve military morale is to praise the troops in speeches while slashing veterans' benefits and combat pay. You have to believe that a good way to fight terrorism is... that one's not so good. You have to believe that providing health care to all Iraqis is sound policy. Do you know that? That we're financing tons of... our tax dollars are going to provide health care to Iraqis. But providing health care to all Americans is socialism. HMOs and insurance companies have the best interest of the public at heart. You have to believe that as well to be a conservative. You have to believe, to be a conservative, that global warming and tobacco's link to cancer are junk science, but creationism should be taught in the schools. You have to believe that a president lying about an extramarital affair is an impeachable offense, but a president lying to enlist support for a war in which thousands die is solid defense policy. You have to believe that the government should limit itself to the powers named in the Constitution, which include banning gay marriage and censoring the Internet. And finally, let me see. Oh, yeah, I like this one. In order to be a conservative, you have to believe that being a drug addict is a moral failing and a crime unless you're a conservative radio talk show host. Then it's an illness and you need our prayers for your recovery. All right. Let's go back to our phones. Peter Werby here with you on WRIF. And here's Tony. Tony, hi. You're on the air.
Peter?
Tony?
Oh, okay. I didn't know if you were talking to me.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm your favorite conservative from Dearborn Heights. I talked to you once before.
Well,
anyway,
you haven't elevated yourself to my favorite because I don't remember you. But go ahead.
I elevated myself.
Yeah.
The laziest people in the auto plants right now are the electricians. And that's not
you know what, man? I don't even want to hear this. I'm just blowing you off totally. And I'll tell you why. Your fader's on, so I can't hear you. No one else can hear you. You're screaming. You're blue in the face. You know, just talking derogatorily about people and you making these assessments, whether you work in an auto plant or not, is just, it's just reprehensible. I mean, I know people that work in industrial work. I've never done industrial work. Actually, I worked construction for about a year and a half or something like that outside, and I loved it. But working inside of a plant, dirty, noisy, what have you. I know members of IBEW here in Detroit, and the men I know that have to work incredible hours, even at union wages, to make a middle-class wage for their families that are probably injuring their health from the kind of work, I just don't want to hear that. The laziest. Get out of here, man. Well, you know, forget it. And if any of you, the rest of you, are on the line waiting to tell me how lazy union workers are, which of course means what? See, this is the politics of resentment. The union workers are lazy. The non-union workers are not. I mean, that's the implication of it all. Well, when you're doing hard work, usually the people do try to, you know, if there's a hole there, hey, you try to make some time for yourself there. I mean, the idea of working 8 straight hours without a break, without taking a nap somewhere, without stopping work for a minute. Well, hey, here's Jacob in Finland.
Hi, Peter.
You're Jacob in Oulu,
that's
Finland?
Right. I decided to call instead of emailing you today.
Oh, my God. Well, welcome to the broadcast.
Remember that Finland has over 99% of its workforce, including professors and everybody else who belongs to unions. 99%. So are we all lazy?
Well, you know what I said about workers of the world, relax. I hope you're taking it easy a little.
Well, I've retired now after my share of work, and because I belong to a union, I enjoy all my benefits even after I've retired. I can travel on the railways at a half price. I can get lots of medical benefits, all because I used to belong to my assistant university assistants union, you know. And the second point I'd like to make, Peter, is that there's a basic difference in thinking about outsourcing and everything else. And that's related to what is cost of living and what is standard of living.
Okay, go ahead.
What is happening in the States is that you have a high cost of living, and therefore you have to pay high wages. If the cost of living comes down, then of course your wages could also come down. So there's a confusion with the two terminologies, cost and standard of living.
Jacob, just tell us quickly, because I know you're calling all the way from Finland. Tell us about
No, no, no problem. The point is, for instance, the standard of living is high, the cost of living is low.
I got you.
So what happens is that's why you have the American companies going there, because they can pay low wages because the cost of living is low.
Yeah.
Whereas in America, the cost of living is high, and therefore they have to pay high wages, and that's why they run away from the States.
Hey, tell us just a little about, since it's Finland is so, the only thing we know about it is, what's the phone company?
we are the most computerized country, the most high-tech country, I think, in the world. We have free medical. We have, well, as I said, 99% of the people belong to all sorts of unions who fight for the benefits of the people. And therefore, we don't have the control of our lives in the hands of the corporates, you know.
What's your minimum wage?
We have a government which is able to do its work because we vote them in and out of power, and we don't have diebold machines which which fix the elections. We walk into the office and push our paper ballot, and within 2 minutes of the polls closing, we have the poll results on the television. You know.
Hey Jacob, what is the minimum wage in Finland?
Well, it is around about 20 euro per hour.
20 euro?
Yeah.
It's like $25,
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, like $25 an hour. And tell us just a little about your town. It's pronounced Oulu?
Oulu, yes. O-H-L-O would be L-O-O, Lou for, it was the second part, but O, as you spelled O-H, you know.
Yeah.
It's a small town of 120,000 people, high-tech, Nokia telephone center for part of the miniaturization process, because it developed out of our university work here when I was in the microelectronics laboratory. And it's a fabulous town to live. It's quiet, and it's a lovely cycling town, and of course we have the winter weather. -30, -35, but every house is heated beautifully, so we don't miss the summer that much. It's two different countries, you know, or cities, one in winter and one in summer. It's green and beautiful, 24-hour sunshine in summer, and white as ever in winter.
Wow, and you're above the Arctic Circle, right?
No, we're just below, a few, maybe about 100 kilometers away from the Arctic Circle.
What can I come visit?
I'd love to have you here with us, Peter. Anytime you want, just make a trip, and we look after you.
All right. Thank you, Jacob.
Lovely to speak to you, Peter.
Great. All right. Thank you very much. Now, if you're wondering, what in the hell does a guy from Finland know anything about the United States? Jacob is very immersed in American talk radio and listens to quite a few shows, including mine. And I think it's like 6 a.m. there now or something like that, or maybe even earlier. But he's a real student of this country. Imagine that, the wages, 99% union. And I forgot to ask him about it, but in all those countries like that, there is guaranteed 30 days vacation and maternity and paternity leave so the mother and father can be with the child. In fact, what they do in some of these countries is if you get, like, say, 30 days vacation and then 30 days paternity leave, the people take them together, so they'll have 60 days paid. This is paid, too. 60 days paid and to be with the child in its first 2 months of life. The mother and father are together with the child for 60 days because, you know what? That's what it means to be pro-family. That's what it means to be pro-life. All the rest of this stuff that you hear out of these mealy-mouthed, lying conservatives is a load of crap of the first magnitude. They couldn't care less about anybody else's families whatsoever, or they would have legislation that created stuff like that. Now, how can we be? Here's Finland, this little teeny country. Or you might say, oh, it's a little teeny country. Well, the United States has the largest accumulation of wealth in the world, and we have the highest amount of poverty of any of the industrialized countries. We have the most incarcerated people, which, of course, goes with poverty. That's why there's so much crime and all of that. We have no national health insurance. Our roads suck. Our schools suck. All of that. What's going on here? And rather than making excuses and saying, well, you know, the company this and Bush this, why don't we take like a country like Finland, for instance, and saying, that could be a model. That's the way we'd like to be. And you know what? It's a peaceful country, too. And people don't hate one another, and they don't call one another names, and they have minorities and what have you. I'm not trying to say it's absolutely without problems. They got more cell phones per capita than anywhere in the world as well. All right, let's move. And if you like Finland so much, why don't you go move there? Give me a ticket, man. Maybe I'll consider it. You know, I see that's a lie, though. There's an old saying, I was born in Detroit, I'm going to die in Detroit, but I'm not going to live in Detroit. I for better or for worse, I'm probably going to make all three. Again, our second call in a row making it international, although I got to say, Jacob from Finland made it much more so than Mark in Windsor, yet we still welcome him. Mark, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, how's it going, Peter?
Going great.
Okay, listen, I try to get away from, I work in an auto plant, I'm a skilled trades worker, and I'm going to try and get away from pointing the finger at the laziest person here for a minute.
Yeah.
I would like to just suggest, this is just an idea that I kind of had with respect to trying to, I don't know, patch up our economy and try and be pro purchasing the products that we make here, you know? Mm-hmm. I think what we could do is possibly, I don't know, how about assign a rating, and this rating would be optimally, it's going to consist of, I don't know, maybe a score from 1 to 100 with the higher score being awarded to the companies that are more perhaps along the lines of being...
Are you talking about the rating the cars?
No, I'm talking about a rating to these products that are what I'm kind of trying to say is that we're more or less rating the company, not the product.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean? Like, if we could possibly assign a part of the factor for being some company that possibly has less, I don't know, stripe when it comes to the contract negotiations, and then we can have another part of this rating that would reward them rather for another aspect of contributing to the economy. You know what I'm saying?
I do indeed, and I appreciate it. Thank you very much. That's what we got to do. Keep thinking about these things. Thanks for making it international, the show. Here is Robert in Commerce. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Peter.
Hi.
I wanted to talk to you about the auto workers. I remember when I was trying to apply for Ford at the Wixom plant, I remember walking in there to fill out an application, and I remember as I walked in there, I seen the workers on the assembly line, and I don't think I have seen one of those guys standing around doing nothing, twiddling their thumbs or sitting on their hands. I remember those guys being busy, you know, putting the cars together and doing their job.
Well, yeah, the line controls people's level of work. In other words, if the line stops, if somebody missed their task at a particular station, putting on motor mounts or whatever the hell, or, you know, dropping the engine in there, you can't say, oh, man, I'm just in the groove room getting high.
Oh, yeah.
Can't do it.
Well, I remember I had to, as I entered the building, I had to, like, walk to, like, the office. And then there was another place that they sent me to get an application. And I remember the people in the office standing around more than any worker there. And it's kind of amazing that you hear all this from people that actually work in some of these places. And you might get, like, maybe somewhere in an instance where somebody has got maybe an easier job than somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
But then they want to point the finger at that person and just kind of like ruin, you know, the reputation of everybody else that works in a plant like that.
Yeah, I knew somebody that worked, what the hell was it? I can't even think of the position, but he worked in a Windsor Ford plant, and he rode a bicycle around, and he was kind of a troubleshooter. Well, a lot of the time, there was no trouble to shoot. I mean, his job was to be available if something broke. I mean, you know, that to fix it. And it's like the skilled tradeswoman who said, if the machines are going, there's nothing much for the people to do that are running the machine. So this guy could screw off a lot, although his position was critical, that when something broke, he had to be there right away and fix it. Because if the line is down, if the line stops, he had to be there right away. So maybe for 4 hours, maybe did nothing. Maybe he, you know, but then, Without him there, the whole operation is screwed. All right, I agree with you, so thank you very much for calling. And let's see, this is applies as well. John from Detroit, you're on the air. Hi.
How you doing?
Doing good.
Listen,
listen, I just had a comment for the caller that called in about the lazy janitor. I was just kind of curious, like, how much money would he want per hour to clean toilets and mop floors and do things like that?
Yeah, well, that's one thing. Well, but think about it. He said he's a college student, computer programmer. How would he even know anything about janitors other than these, like, urban myths that I said? And the same thing. They have janitors that are there during the day, and there's maybe nothing spilled. I mean, if there's an oil, you know, some fluid spill, man, this guy better be there. But it's not just cleaning up. At, like, here, we have this great janitorial staff that comes in and cleans WRIF after we are all, or most of us are gone. I'm always here at night frequently, so I see them. And they appear to be working their butt off. No one realizes what they're doing. I mean, for all I know, maybe when they get a chance, they just are watching television in some of the one of the rooms. But I know that the place is clean. I'm not saying they do that. So, yeah, it was an extraordinarily dumb comment. Thank you. Brian, write back or something like that. Tell us what's going on. I want to hear what you think now that you've heard all this. Here's Jamie in Mount Morris. Hi, you're on WRIF.
Hey, how you doing?
Doing good.
It's kind of in relation to the computer programmer who's complaining about the janitor's job. But I hope he realizes that they're doing more and more outsourcing of computer programming to India.
Yeah, sure.
And because they're doing it a lot right now with like call centers, like now people who take calls for like for medical bills and stuff like that. So I work in the collection business myself, and I am a computer programmer. And finding that these companies are outsourcing their extended business offices to Indian call centers.
Right.
And they're coming to find out that it's not working out as well as they thought it would. So.
Well, there are drawbacks to it, but the main thing they're looking for, of course, is low wages. All right, I got to go. Got to end the show. Thank you. Sorry if I've left people on the hook here. We'll get you next week. Thanks for listening. Thanks for calling. Stay tuned for the interviews on Night Call.
And now, a word from the Riff Legal Eagles. Unless otherwise stated, all entrants for WRIF contests must be at least 18 years of age and a legal resident of the United States. A household is eligible to win one contest per 30 days every 6 months for prizes valued at $600 or higher. Radio Media Detroit and its affiliates, promotional sponsors, advertising and promotional agencies, and other radio and television stations in the Detroit ADI are not eligible to participate. One entry per person. No purchase or other consideration is necessary to participate in the contest. Void where prohibited. Prizes are not transferable or redeemable for cash. 101 WRIF reserves the right to substitute any prize for one of equal or greater value. By participating in the contest, contestants consent to the broadcast and or publication of their name, voice, face, and or likeness without compensation. Participants listening online at www.wrif.com may receive audio that is delayed by as much as 60 seconds later than the over-the-air transmission, which could potentially affect chances of winning. General contest rules are available online at www.wrif.com or during regular business hours at the WRIF Studios, 1 Radio Plaza, Detroit, Michigan, 48220.
This is WRIF.com. Conscience show.
Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. We've been bringing back a lot of our great interview authors, haven't we? And this week is no exception. Christopher Baker was on the show at least once, or maybe I've played his interview a couple of times before, so I think he's been on more than once. We'll ask him. The last time we spoke with Christopher Baker, it was about his travel journeys through Cuba. The book was called Mi Moto Fidel, and that is Motorcycling Through Castro's Cuba. And Chris Baker has just traveled everywhere, written travel books on any number of locations, particularly in the Caribbean. And he also has the definitive tour book on Cuba, published by Moon Books. And he's back with us, this time something near and dear to the hearts of us here in the Motor City, Detroit. It's called Cuba Classics, a celebration of vintage American automobiles. It's published by Interlink Books, and it's 200 pages of incredible vintage cars. Chris Baker, welcome back to the Peter Werby Show.
Thank you very much, Peter. It's a delight to be with you again.
Now, tell us, let's not make any assumptions. I always think that most people know that when you go to Cuba, automobile history stopped in essentially 1959 when the revolution occurred. Is that essentially true?
Well, there you go. That's the fact. It really did. The door slammed shut, and moreover, the Cuban government does not permit Cubans to buy contemporary cars. And so they've been clinging to these old relics, these wonderful old cars. And what was amazing for me during many years of traveling through Cuba is I'd be going down the road and I'd be passed by a Kaiser or a Hudson. All these wonderful cars that disappeared from the roadways of America years ago.
Now, we may be. In fact, I would look forward to repeating this this interview because I'm anticipating it being as good as the last one where you chronicled your motorcycle tour through Cuba. Now, going through Cuba, getting all these photographs you told me before the before our interview over the last 10 years, and particularly in the last 3 years, we are coming up this weekend when this is being aired to something called where we bring in almost like a million people, and it's called, it's right out of my brain, the cruise. We have this Motor City Cruise, which is not, how weird, I can't think of the name of it right now, when a million people are going to be coming into our town with these same kind of automobiles that are, that you chronicle. Now, is there an attempt to make these look like the way the people do here in Detroit, to keep them in vintage shape?
Well, that really is wishful thinking. These are really beasts of burden, and it doesn't matter if you're talking about an old Cadillac or a Hudson or a Studebaker. These are everyday vehicles for Cubans, and so just keeping them running is the hardest part. There is no attempt nor even any possibility of being 100% true to the original. There are no replacement parts. Most of these cars are cobbled together and held together by wire and faith. But occasionally you'll see, very infrequently, you'll see a real gem. Many of the best models have actually been bought up by foreigners living there, the embassy staff, etc.
Now, if you have a 55 Chevy Impala hardtop, you're in Detroit and you're here this Saturday for the big event, you're very self-conscious, you're very aware that you've got this car that's half a century old. Is there that self-consciousness among the Cubans?
Well, not really, because these cars are such a day-to-day element of Cuban culture. It may surprise you to learn that about 1 in 8 cars on the road in Cuba is a pre-revolutionary vehicle, many of them dating back to the 1920s or so. It's true to say that almost on any one day, certainly outside of Havana, you may see a Model T Ford chugging down the road, and it's being used. these aren't roses to be cuddled on a Sunday, brought out of the garage on a Sunday. These are working vehicles. So they're just part of daily life. They're taken for granted. In fact, Cadillacs, pre-59 Cadillacs, are the backbone of the taxi fleet throughout the nation.
Really? Now, I was going to actually say something, but I probably ought to be a little wary, and we'll talk in a minute about what kind of penalties are involved for Americans traveling to Cuba, but a friend of mine was married recently in Cuba. I was going to mention the town, but I probably won't even do that. And there were he and his bride smiling, and in back was, oh, I'm forgetting my car. It's probably like a 57 or actually they changed, like a 58 Chevy, and it was kind of dolled up with wedding kind of stuff. Are they used for special occasion? I mean, you did say they're the workhorses, but are they also recognized as a prestige item?
Yeah, there are two elements to that. One thing is that one of the wonderful things about being in Cuba is, of course, to see these cars working, passing down the road. But the best models, especially the convertibles, are hired out for, especially for weddings and for the 15th birthday celebrations of young girls, which is celebrated as their coming of age. And they're dolled up, and you know they'll be hired out for $20, $30, $40 or so for the day. And they're an important source of income in a nation where trying to, you know, fighting for a good income is a hardship. So this is one of the great delights, especially on a Sunday.
Now, in your book, Cuba Classics, a celebration of vintage American automobiles. You must have had some favorites. What ones stand out? And is it just all visual, or was it the people connected with them?
Well, the book is not just a photographic celebration of the cars. It's really a story about the part that cars play in contemporary culture. And just as you would imagine here, people, many Cubans are totally into cars and totally into maintaining their old cars to the best of their abilities. Yes, I do have some of my favorite cars, but mostly they're to do with the people associated with them and some of the anecdotes that I had. If I may tell a brief one, I was on the Seafront Boulevard at dusk, this is in Havana, and crept up upon a 1959 Oldsmobile 88, beautiful vehicle. And I was down on my haunches taking photos with the sun shining, you know, the sun really low, red upon this green and white car. I thought I'd take some photos inside, and when I stood up to take photos inside, I found a couple on the front seat. And, you know, they were kissing, and they were lovers, and they smiled at me, waved. I took a photo, and about a month later, I went back to Cuba and gifted photos to the driver. When I arrived at his home, his wife answered the door. I realized I'd been photographing him and his mistress.
Oh. Well, you know, that that actually reminds me. I was thinking there's a Bob Seger song where they're talking about, he's talking about the back seats of these cars. Well, most modern American cars, and certainly European cars, there very little can go on in either the front or the back. However, in those big behemoths of the 50s, they, in fact, I think Khrushchev called them stinky sofas on wheels. are they in like popular lore the centers of amorous activity?
Well, certainly. I mean, Cuba is quite libertine in that way, and yes, they are. But mostly, particularly because there is such a shortage of housing, and so yes.
Yes, is the answer. All right, this is a family show, so we won't go any further than that. My guest is Christopher P. Baker, and he is the author of Cuba Classics from Interlink Books, just published. And you can go to cuba-automobiles.com, cuba-automobiles.com. I'll have that on my website as well. And we're talking about the cars that never, they kind of froze in amber after the 1959 Cuban Revolution. But there's got to be, when you said that's just American cars, so what do they have, like Russian Ladas and all those kind of clunkers that never worked real well?
Yes, those are there, and if and hopefully soon when Cuba is opened up to American travelers are going to be in for a shock, because the Mercedes there are there, the modern Volvos are there, the modern Japanese automobiles are there. They've been importing cars since the revolution from Europe. Most of those cars, the vast majority, of course, are owned by the Cuban government. Modern Mercedes are actually a backbone of the tourist taxi fleet. Hmm. As are Peugeot and Renaults from France. But for about 20 or 30 years, of course, most of the cars that were imported between the revolution and the fall of the Soviet Union were Ladas. You know, they're all pretty much all lemons, but they are by far the most numerous vehicle in Cuba, and they're gifted out by or leased out by the Cuban government to workers, to party officials, etc. But I think every Cuban secretly wishes to have a pre-1959, at least a working model. The mid-50s Chevys are really particularly sought after.
Just like here.
Yeah, they're considered the most reliable. And, of course, the Studebakers, which are so numerous, it's incredible how
really?
Studebakers are there. But they're in Cuba, they're referred to as Stude no gracias, for no thank you, because they're not considered to be the most reliable vehicle.
Do they have those? I used to have one of those low-slung Raymond Loewy design two-door ones that they began that looked like were the predecessor of those Super Hawks.
Mm-hmm. They're there.
Wow.
You name me an American model, and I can swear it'll be there. I think the only model that I've not seen is in 1957, Cadillac made an Eldorado Brougham. There were only about 700 of them made.
Ah.
I've been looking for one. I can't find one.
How about Nash Ramblers, those little two-seaters?
Plenty. And the funny thing is, before I conceived doing this book, of course, I was working on another books in Cuba and photographing. And, of course, I love American cars, so I was photographing these cars. But I didn't photograph any Nashes because I didn't consider them particularly an attractive vehicle. And that was the case for many other vehicles that I passed in Cuba. And it was only later when I came to research this book and began, because I'm English and I don't know my American car models, or at least didn't until researching this book. But as soon as I started to research, I realized that I'd failed to photograph some very rare vehicles in Cuba. And then I made up for it by photographing some Nashes.
Did you say, I forgot, what class of people have the older cars? Is it, I mean, dumb old me. I mean, I thought that these were like the only cars. Why I wouldn't have figured it out that there were cars from other countries is beyond me. But who has the old vintage cars? Is it the middle class or the poor or who?
Well, there's really no such thing as, you know, the middle class as such anymore. There are certainly people who are favored, such as the communist bureaucrats. But no, these cars are sprinkled throughout society. Of course, many people who did not leave after the revolution, who were middle class or upper class, they kept their cars. A lot of those cars were left behind by people who fled Cuba for Miami, and those cars were seized, and they were either seized by people who moved into Havana and just as opportunists took the vehicles, or they were taken by the Cuban government and handed out, gifted, if you will, to various other individuals. So all walks of society.
Mm-hmm. Chris Baker, you told me before the show as well that your book Cuba Classics is just part one of a trilogy you're doing on the second one, which I think of as very Cuban. I never thought about the third, but tell us about the one about baseball.
Well, this coffee table book, which is what Cuba Classics is, will be a trilogy of very similar books that is a photographic celebration of baseball within Cuban culture. I'm just beginning work on that, just as I'm beginning work on a similar book on the dogs of Cuba, because dogs are a very important part of Cuban culture also. So I want to focus on the three things that I think Americans have an affinity for, a passion and a love for. Old cars, baseball, and dogs fits that bill, but also themes that are very important within Cuban society.
Well, of course, Cuban baseball players are legendary. In fact, Tia, maybe since you're pretty savvy on Cuba stuff, I read a novel about 3 or 4 years ago that featured the young Fidel Castro as a pitcher. Was an American down there? Does that ring any bells?
It rings a lot of bells. In fact, there's actually more of a misconception that he tried out for the Washington Senators. From my research recently, it seems that was not the case. That is not to dismiss Fidel as not having come up to par, if you will, as a baseball player. He was an exceptionally good pitcher and an extremely gifted all-round sports figure in his youth. In fact, he won the Cuban National Championship as the athlete of the year when he was about, I think, 18 or 19 or so.
Yeah, actually, in the novel I read, that figures in it, a tryout with the old Washington Senators. By the way, I just, all I got to do is wait. My mother always used to say, if anything's important, when you say you can't remember something, she says, if it was important, you'll remember. It's the Woodward Dream Cruise. Why in the world that didn't pop to my mind, since this is going to dominate for, you know, a week ahead with all these old cars. Many of which are now residing in Cuba, chronicled in the book Cuba Classics, Celebration of Vintage American Automobiles. My guest on the Peter Werby Show, Christopher Baker, the author. Dogs?
I'll tell you how it happened. I was in Cuba for one day. I'd gone to a conference in Mexico vis-a-vis Cuba and U.S. relations. And I went into Cuba for the day and actually had an interview with Fidel. But I was with an NBC film crew during the afternoon, and we were walking through the streets of Havana, and the cameraman pointed his camera at a mutt, just a mutt lazing in the sun. And the dog looked, saw the camera, and rolled on its back and spread all four legs and hammed for the camera. I swear that the entire street roared with laughter.
Really?
And I thought back to, there's a series of very successful books on the cats of Greece. There are 10 coffee table books by photographer called Hans Sylvester on the theme of cats in Greece, and do very, very well. And at that moment, I realized that in my stock photography, I've got some very wonderful photos of dogs. And dogs are a very important part of Cuban society. I'm going back in November for the International Dog Show in Havana.
Really?
So a lot of the dogs, a lot of families, even though they're hard-pressed to put food on the table, life isn't too easy, nonetheless love their dogs, and every pedigree of dog you can imagine exists in Cuba. But the second side is that about 50% of the dogs in Cuba are street dogs, and most of those, and many of those dogs, were put out on the streets after the collapse of the Soviet Union. Particularly 1992-93 were terrible years for Cuba and the Cuban people. Malnutrition returned. It was very difficult to feed oneself. And so they put the dogs out on the street because they couldn't keep them alive. They ate the cats. Cats disappeared from the streets of Cuba, but nobody could bear to eat their dogs. So these delightful creatures are a very important part of Cuban society. Cubans love dogs and treat them very, very well.
Now, as you're saying, and we can tell by this interview, Chris, that you've been to Cuba any number of times. I loved your I'm looking at a travel book. Is that a best travel adventure? Let's call it Mi Moto Fidel, where you traveled through this island. What did that I remember? Let me see if I remember my lessons from reading your moon travel guide on Cuba. It's 700 miles long. How am I doing?
A little bit more, but not, you know, you're in the ballpark.
Okay, and you drove your motorcycle 5,000 miles.
Actually, 7,000 miles.
Oh man, yeah. Through Cuba, collecting the material for the travel book.
Exactly.
Well, you've been in the United States for you said about 20 years. I say every time I talk to you, your English accent diminishes more. You're going to be saying France and chance pretty soon.
Well, that's because I'm in California on the West Coast. Maybe if I were closer to England on the East Coast, I wouldn't be losing it.
Now, are you an American citizen?
I am these days, yes.
So how can you go to Cuba when most other people can't?
I'm a full-time professional journalist, accredited journalist, and go for research reasons. That's basically it.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about someone like myself who does interviews like this, that does a lot of news reporting? Can I just hop on a plane and
actually, yes, you can. There are certain categories. There are two categories of journalists, and those who are freelancers who have a very a questionable status as full-timers would certainly have to apply for what's called a specific license from the U.S. Treasury Department to go to spend money in Cuba. There's no restriction on travel per se. It's on trading.
Spending money. But as I remember from your book, I could travel under what's called a general license?
You could, because you are employed by an accredited broadcasting entity. So, yes, you could go under a general license. Mm. Having said that, the regulations change frequently, and I would point you to the Treasury Department, point anybody to the Treasury Department's website to look up the latest, because certainly in late June, there were some very, very significant changes came out of the Bush administration that changed the regulations as to who can go to Cuba and under what conditions.
Yeah, and they tightened it up. Actually.
Very much so.
Right. Now, as it stands, people that are eight or 9 miles south of me in Windsor can just get on a plane and fly directly to Holguín in the eastern sector of Cuba. Yet if we're just a mile south of that and on the Detroit side, you're subject to fines now. I think they've made them huge, haven't they?
Well, the fines themselves have not changed. What has changed is that there was never any prosecutions, never have been any prosecutions of anybody spending money illegally in Cuba. That has changed in that they nominated three judges to oversee the backlog of cases of people who have been accused of spending money illegally in Cuba. So that's changed, but also they are definitely beginning to, or have begun to, police more to try and identify individuals who are going to Cuba illegally. It's absolutely ridiculous, given that I think there are about 20 staff members in the U.S. Treasury Department whose job it is to try and impose these sanctions on travel to Cuba, but only three of those staffers trying to trace monies of Al-Qaeda internationally, etc. It's absolutely ludicrous. But nothing has ever been sane between U.S.-Cuba relations for four decades.
Now, I must know a minimum of 20 people that have been to Cuba, and they've never had a knock on the door, never got a letter. Are they home free, or could they be in danger of getting a fine?
Well, it depends. I mean, the laws are on the books, and if one has been identified as having gone to Cuba and spent money there, there's always a possibility that, it might be 5 years ago, but the knock may come on the door. But I think the chances of that are very, very minimal indeed.
Mm-hmm. Now, you talked about indicated pretty early in our interview that when things got back to normal, some people fear a return to normalcy, I guess it is, Cuba will become sort of just like Aruba, the way some of these little enclaves for Canadian and European tourists are, that right now that Cuba has a spirit and a quality to it that could quickly be destroyed if the United States and Cuba weren't at odds.
Well, that's certainly true. If you've read me Motto Fidel, you certainly know that I have two minds as to the Cuban government. I acknowledge the wonderful things that the Castro government has done without being misled as to the fact that it's been an intensely destructive process and caused immense hardship and continues to do so for a lot of people, not least in individual freedoms. But the one thing, to take up your particular point there, the one thing that is so notable and so distinct and individual about Cuba is that the last four decades of America being held at arm's length has enabled Cuba not only to preserve a traditional culture, but also to really sponsor traditional culture. And if you go to an island close by, Puerto Rico, for example, whilst there's a lot of Puerto Rican culture still alive, nonetheless, you know very well that you're in an offshoot of America, mainland America. And I fear that very quickly that will happen. There are no McDonald's in Cuba right now. There's actually one on Guantanamo Naval Base. But there are no mainstream, there's no KFC, Walmart, etc. And that is already beginning to change as Cuban government initiates its Cuban equivalents of those entities. But really what I'm trying to say is that as soon as the embargo is lifted, and that's assuming that there's a radical change in government, and that's not a given that will happen, then there will be wholesale change because the corporations, the big corporations, see a population of 11 million people that's virginal in the sense of business opportunity.
Any sense of what Cuba would look like after Castro is gone, assuming he dies a natural death? Will communism go on, or will that be the signal for the unraveling?
Well, I personally believe there will be an unraveling. I think there's an inevitability to it, but it may be a slow process. His brother, Raul, younger brother, who is a dedicated communist, is number two in line, and they have certainly prepared themselves very well for Fidel's passing. I think the key is what will happen in Washington. There will certainly be a lot of turmoil within Cuba because 50% of the population or so do support at least some elements of the current situation there. 50% are dying for change and freedom. What the Cuban-Miamians, Cuban-American elite do in Miami and what Washington does to support them, I think, is critical to whether Raul Castro will be able to consolidate his hold. So very, very difficult question to answer.
Mm-hmm. Well, the book, and a handsome one it is, filled with photographs of cars that would just make all of us tingle on a dream cruise weekend here in Detroit. The book is called Cuba Classics, a celebration of vintage American automobiles. It's published by Interlink Books. You can go to Cuba-automobiles.com. And what about, should people check out this travelguidebooks.com? Is that going to go directly to you, or do you have to have...
That is actually my personal website.
Okay. And if you're traveling somewhere, Chris Baker's probably been there, particularly in the Caribbean, so you might want to check that out. As usual, Chris Baker, thanks for joining me on the Peter Werby Show.
Peter, it's a great pleasure to be with you again. I look forward to another opportunity soon.
Like a song you just heard?
Oh, yeah!
Listen up.
Then head on over to the Digital Riff Music Store at WRIF.com and download your favorite riff tunes for just 99 cents.
Next song.
Stay connected. With 101 WRIF and WRIF.com. Everything that rocks.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Junior is great.
More Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Boy, the economy. It's real easy, and I've said it before. The economy sucks, and Bush has lost millions of jobs. It's a deficit economy. There was a surplus. And then you read a lot of the media, and it says, oh, the economy's coming back, and jobs are being created. And how do you know what to believe? I mean, that's what's always so difficult for me. One of the things I do is turn to people who I trust. And one of them is someone who I've had on the show before. Her name is Ellen Frank. And she is the senior economic analyst for the Poverty Institute at Rhode Island College in and lives in Boston. And her brand new book from Beacon is The Raw Deal, How Myths and Misinformation About the Deficit, Inflation and Wealth Impoverish America. Ellen Frank, welcome back to the Peter Werbe Show.
Thank you, Peter.
Well, one of the things that I'm not is organized, and somehow with this, it's even more so. I mean, I have any number of questions that I'm curious about and wonder whether my assumptions are correct and what have you. But, if you were me, where would you start? Where in this huge thing we call the economy and our wages and our jobs, is there an entry point that makes any sense?
I think that's exactly the problem, is that people come at it from different entry points, and some of them make sense to some people and not to others. And what the book is about is the way in which the entry point, or the issues that are most important and most significant to wealthy people, and particularly to financial firms and to Wall Street firms and companies that are, that pay their employee, their chief executives and stock options, and people who have a huge interest in the financial markets, have pretty much dominated the economic conversation in the last decade, really for the last 20 years, but especially in the last decade, so that ordinary people for whom wages and salaries and, the number of jobs are really the most important things, the things that dictate how our lives are going to go economically, are pretty much left out of the conversation and have instead been encouraged to look at the economy through the lens of Wall Street. And, an example of that is in one of the chapters in the book is about the efforts during the 1980s and 90s to interest ordinary Americans and get ordinary Americans excited about the fortunes of the stock market. The stock market, of course, we hear a lot about Wall Street and whether stocks are doing well or badly, as if this was a matter of great significance to ordinary people. And in fact, it is not a matter of great significance to ordinary people. Most people own very little stock. Even people who have stock in retirement accounts have very small quantities, very small dollar amounts. About two-thirds of Americans who have stocks own only about $8,000 worth of stock, not nearly enough to finance retirement. And what's happened over the last 20 years is that people are told to be excited when the stock market's doing well and to watch their 401ks and their portfolios go up when the stock market's going well. But one of the things that makes the stock market do well is when the economy isn't doing so well for people who earn wages and salaries. So if profits go up and wages go down, then stock prices go up. And people are encouraged to cheer this, even though it means that their own economic security is actually declining. I think that for most people, the entry point that we want to come to the economy from is, how many jobs is the economy creating? What's the quality of those jobs? Do they pay good wages? And especially if the economy is growing, is the growth being equitably, or is most of the growth flowing into the hands of a small number of wealthy executives and financial firms and corporations who are, sitting on huge piles of profits while wages are stagnating? And that's what's happened over the last few years, is that wages have been stagnant, and it's not because the economy is doing badly. In aggregate numbers, the economy is doing well, but the problem is that most people aren't sharing in any of that wealth creation.
Well, let's talk a little about jobs, and actually, I mean, that was a great summation for the picture of the economy as we can see it now. Last year, and as you remember, Ellen Frank, that I had you as a guest on the now defunct IE America Radio Network when I was hosting that full-time nationally syndicated show, and I got blown out of that job. And I went almost that next Sunday. I went to a family brunch on my wife's side. And there was her brother, who had just lost his job, had just been fired, and her cousin, who had just been fired. This is from white-collar managerial positions. And all of a sudden, we said, the three of us, is there a pattern here? and there is, isn't there?
There's definitely a pattern. I mean, it's not so much. I mean, first of all, of course, the last few years has been terrible for the labor market. Right after Bush took office, the economy lost about 3 million jobs. Only slightly fewer than 2 million of those have been replaced. A lot of the ones that have been replaced have been replaced through government hiring, not through private sector hiring. So the labor market is terrible. And, this is over a 3-year period. We've actually lost a net about 2 million private sector jobs. in a time when, you know, more people are entering the labor market, people are graduating from high school and college and looking for jobs. And so, you know, things are really not going well, for the ordinary job holder. And even when people retain their jobs, stories like the one you just told make everybody feel insecure, because you hear about other people losing their jobs, you hear about companies shipping jobs overseas, you hear about companies eliminating health coverage for their employees, and that makes people feel more economically insecure. And in fact, people are more economically insecure. And one of the arguments that I make in the book is that, you know, the way in which market economies function is through these boom and bust cycles. Market economies are inherently unstable. You have these periods of very rapid growth, you know, usually because some new technology has come on board. There's a lot of excitement about it. Businesses are investing very heavily in new equipment, and that creates a lot of demand, and, you know, employers take on new employees, and things go really well, and people are very, you know, happy about their economic prospects. But those periods don't tend to last very long. After 3 or 4 years, there'll be a bust, and investment will dry up, and businesses will stop making these new investments, and they'll lay people off, and they'll be nervous about the future and be afraid of hiring new workers. And that's the kind of period we're in now. And the way to prevent that from happening, or to prevent the economic insecurity that comes about as a result of that for most people, is through deliberate, and consistent government economic policy that promotes job growth and full employment. And it's that we haven't seen in the last, you know, decade or two. We haven't seen the response from the government at the federal level, at the national level, where the government, the national government has these really tremendous powers to create jobs and to promote a full employment economy, and they haven't been using that power for fear of causing inflation and because of pressure from Wall Street to stop government borrowing or to reduce government spending.
Well, Ellen Frank, I can just hear, I think, some of my listeners saying, well, she must be a liberal. There she goes. She wants the government to mess in all this rather than the free hand of the market, creating jobs and eliminating those unproductive, uneconomic sectors. Government intervention in the popular mind has a pretty bad rap.
Well, I mean, the question is, I mean, government intervention is inevitable. The government intervenes in the economy and in, you know, the political arena constantly. That's what government is. I mean, an economy can't exist without a set of laws and regulations and, all kinds of, government aid and help on at every level. And we see that, you know, whether the government claims to be a conservative, libertarian, small government, or whether it claims to be a liberal, big government. The question is, on whose behalf does it intervene and for what purpose? In the post-war period, the U.S. government and most governments of Western countries, of developed countries, of market economies, most governments intervened to create employment. Not necessarily to create government employment, although that was part of it, but to promote employment growth and wage growth in the private sector. And there are ways that you can do that. One of the ways you do that is by protecting wages and trying to prevent them from falling in a downturn by having strong minimum wage laws, for example. Another way governments can do that is by having, strong social insurance programs so that when people lose their jobs, they aren't left destitute, that there are things that they can fall back on, like public sector health care and things like that. That's, of course, it's liberal, the context of today's politics to talk about this is considered almost, it's almost outside of the political mainstream to talk about this, and yet that's how the government operated for many, many years, and it's largely a result of the government, organizing policy that way until really the Reagan Revolution of the 1980s. It's a result of that kind of government intervention that led to the growth of the middle class. Because if you don't have that government intervention, then what you have is a market that operates through these boom and bust cycles, and the middle class and people who depend on wages and salaries for their, you know, economic security are left in a much, much worse circumstances. And we've seen that in this country. In the past 25 years, wage growth has been stagnant. Even in the few periods when wages grew, like during the boom of the mid-1990s, most of the growth in wages could be explained by the fact that families were sending more members out into the labor force, that women started working and stopped staying at home with children, that people worked longer hours. And so when you look at the actual history of what happens when the government stops intervening on behalf of wage and salary earners, what happens is that wage and salary earners' economic security starts to deteriorate, and it's deteriorated very markedly in this country, and the result has been a dramatic increase in economic inequality, where the economy will grow by 3% or 4% or 5% in a given year, but when you look at what's happened to 80% of the population, you find that they haven't benefited at all, and that in some cases wages have actually fallen. So where is the growth going? Where is that additional income going? And it turns out that it's going to the top 1% or sometimes even 0.5% of the population. One of the studies that I cite in the book is a study that was conducted a couple of years ago for the National Bureau of Economic Research that found that most of the benefits of economic growth from the 1980s through the 1990s went not just to the top 10% or the top 20%, but actually flowed to about 13,000 families.
Wow.
You know, a very, very small number of people, mostly very wealthy people, CEOs, and you have cases of people walking away from companies with $100 million, $700 million, $1 billion. And this is the way that markets function when you don't have policies that are directed toward promoting employment.
Ellen Frank's my guest on the Peter Werby Show. Her brand new book for Beacon is The Raw Deal, How Myths and Misinformation About the Deficit, Inflation, and Wealth Impoverish America. And, the government has always intervened in the economy harshly in the 19th century, both here in England, for instance, with anti-combination acts that forbid workers to unionize. And when they had the temerity to do so, they would intervene in strikes by sending out troops to break strikes and what have you. So there's always been an intervention, Ellen Frank says, on whose behalf is the government going to intervene. Now, you talked about job creation, and I noticed that here's this excuse that's rising. Us workers, our medical costs are too high. That's why they can't create more jobs, because we want health care, and the companies just can't afford it.
Well, this is a very serious problem with the health delivery system in the United States. And, you know, one of the things I talk about in the book is not the details of the healthcare system, on which I am not an expert, but the ways in which economic arguments about deficits and inflation and these sort of macroeconomic financial arguments have been used to pretty much stymie debate or stalemate debate about what the proper response is to rising healthcare costs. There's no question that healthcare costs have been rising. They've been rising at 2-3, sometimes even 4 times the underlying rate of inflation. It's become a tremendous burden on large companies that give healthcare to their employees because their premiums are rising, you know, faster than their other costs. And yet the interesting thing about the United States is that when you look at the total government spending on healthcare, what the federal government spends and state government spend on Medicaid and Medicare, most of this is on behalf of the elderly and disabled, and you look at the total dollars that are spent on, you know, healthcare system to, you know, at the government level, and it turns out that the U.S. government actually spends more combined on a per-person basis on healthcare than does, for example, the government of France. Although in France, everybody has health coverage, and it's all provided through the public system, whereas in the United States, we have 40 million people unemployed, without health insurance, 44 million people without health insurance, and millions more whose health coverage is very insecure because it's employment-based. So it's true that we have a very, very screwed up, I don't know how else to put it, healthcare delivery system. And, you know, we need to do something about that. And if companies are unable to afford to provide health benefits, then we need to really start to have a public conversation about how health insurance is going to be provided or who's going to provide for healthcare.
Well, I was just about to say you're speaking in strictly economic terms till you said screwed up. So I was going to say a lot of my terms that I use, I talk about looting within the economy. It used to be, and tell me, I mean, I'm one thing, I'm I'm sort of fact-checking here to make sure what I'm saying on the air is correct, that particularly in being centered here in Detroit, is that the UAW Big Three contracts, the rise in wages in the 40s and the 50s where it's tied to rising productivity. So if the productivity of the workers because of technology and what have you, the Big Three would willingly give raises. But now that we see these great rises, tremendous rises in productivity of the overall workforce of the United States, and as you said, there's the sharing of the wealth has flatlined.
Right, because the rise in productivity, instead of going to the workers, is going into the corporate profits, and that's where it's showing up. And so despite productivity gains, people don't see increases in their standard of living, or at least most people don't see increases in their standard of living. And an interesting question to ask is, well, why is it that, you know, in the 40s and 50s and 60s and really into the 70s, why is it that the UAW and other big unions were able to negotiate contracts like this where, if there was a 5% rise in productivity, they would see a 5% increase in their real wages? And the answer is, it has to do with a couple of things. One is that unions were much stronger and more powerful. They represented more workers. They had more bargaining power. The second was that companies were more willing to work with unions because they believed that the government was essentially going to intervene on behalf of wage and salary earners in its economic policy anyway. And so that would keep wage and salary earners in a position politically where they would have, strong negotiating power. What changed is that during the 1980s and 90s, the government, it made it clear at the national level, beginning with Reagan, that it was no longer going to intervene on behalf of wage and salary earners, that the government was no longer saw itself as having a role in promoting full employment. And if the government didn't have a role in promoting full employment, then there wouldn't be full employment. And so what we've seen over the last, 10, 20 years is that unemployment rates have been higher on average. There's been more people working part-time, unable to find full-time jobs, more people who are dropping out of the labor force because they're discouraged. And in general, and in fact, this is a very interesting point that I make in the book. In general, the consensus among the policy elites, among people who make economic policy and who talk about economic policy at the national level and in the Federal Reserve, is that American workers have become, in the words of Alan Greenspan, traumatized. That American workers are so traumatized by the insecure economy of the last 20 years and by their fear that they're going to lose their health benefits, or they're going to lose their job, that they are no longer willing to or able to, press for higher wages. And so when productivity increases, instead of saying, hey, we want a piece of that, they feel that they're lucky just to have their jobs, mm-hmm. just to keep on to their jobs. And so they're even willing to take pay cuts and cuts in benefits while productivity is increasing. And the result has been a shift in income distribution where more of the country's income is going toward what economists call capital income, dividends and interest and corporate profits, and less of it is going toward wage and salary income.
Well, Ellen Frank, I don't know whether this is within your field, but I mean, it almost seems like pathology. I mean, we, on the part of the elite, I mean, they have more money than they can ever spend, and it would make a lot more sense, even in their terms, to keep the social terrain peaceful, to not have great numbers of people angry or upset or what have you. I mean, it once you have $10 million, what are you going to do with $15 million? I mean, I sometimes just chalk it up to this ruling pathology.
Yeah, I think pathology is probably a good word, and I don't really know how else to explain it. I mean, you can explain it to some degree by competition. When businesses feel that they're in a very competitive environment, and the globalization of the economy has made more businesses feel that they're in a competitive environment, then, people feel that they need to accumulate as much wealth as possible. Business owners feel that they need to accumulate as much wealth as possible. And of course, the general population, even if you don't have a lot of money, when you believe, rightfully believe, given the political tenor of the country that the government isn't going to address the health care problems in the country, and it isn't going to address the education problems in the country, and it isn't going to address the problems of affordability of college education in the country, then you believe that if nobody's going to address this, then you're going to have to take care of it yourself. And the only way to do that is to amass greater and greater amounts of wealth. The problem is that, you know, when people start thinking that way, there's only a small number of people who are actually going to succeed in amassing huge amounts of wealth. And, you know, one of the situations we have in this country is that, you know, people, you know, a small number of people have accumulated such vast amounts of wealth, and their lifestyles are presented to the rest of us as what we should strive for, then if everybody wants the government off their back so that they have a better shot at getting there themselves, but of course, you know, it's very unlikely that most people will ever attain that. Most of us...
It's like poor kids dreaming about being basketball stars.
That's
right.
I mean,
there will be a few. Let me do this. I know I did cut you off, but we only have about 4 minutes left, and I was just going to, so maybe some short questions of information and your opinion. People hear the Dow closed today at 10,436, and they go, 10,000 what? I mean, what is, I mean, we kind of know if it's above 10,000, it's good. If it's up, it's good. If it's down, it's bad. What is the 10,000 counting?
Oh, well, the 10,000 is an index number. What it is it's an average of the stock prices of about 40 stocks. And I can't even remember exactly how it's put together, but the Dow Jones Bureau is a private organization that puts together a sort of average of the stocks of what are called blue chip companies.
Mm-hmm.
These are very stable, well-established companies like General Electric and IBM.
How about when you want information on the economy, and there's these shows like on CNN and Foxhole News and stuff like that, worth watching in your estimation?
Well, you know, I think they're worth watching sometimes, but, you know, there's been no doubt that in the last few years, the bias on all these economic news programs on television and to some extent in the newspapers and magazines as well has been toward the financial markets. And so you'll
Cheerlady.
Have a show on the economy, and all of this is about the Dow and the economic news that's very good for Wall Street, and you won't hear very much about what's happening to wages or what's happening to the average worker's job security, except insofar as that might affect consumer confidence and sales of businesses. So it's economics very much from the perspective of business owners and the wealthy.
Mm-hmm. Now, when I travel, in fact, I was in your city, Boston, in June, and certainly travel around Detroit, and one would think, boy, things are just going great. The restaurants are filled. You go to events, and they're done well. Stores are filled. You hear machines going, doing improvements everywhere. Anecdotally, you would think this isn't an economy that's doing poorly, or even that the people are not doing as well as they could. That I suppose. Do you think that it looks bad to most people, or does it depend of whether I said earlier whether you're sitting in a restaurant with two other people talking about losing your job?
Well, I think I think the U.S. economy, first of all, is very rich. I mean, we're one of the richest countries in the world. And so even when you're poor in America, you're not as poor as you a poor person in Brazil or, Venezuela or something. It's not that we're doing badly. I think the question is, are we doing as well as we could be doing, given the resources we have? I mean, when you have a GDP of $10 trillion or $11 trillion, which is what the United States economy generates in income every year, if you distributed that fairly equally, not necessarily everybody gets the same amount, but fairly equally, sort of the way it was distributed in the 40s and 50s, where there's, a very small number of people who make, really extraordinary incomes in the tens of millions of dollars, then people can do a lot better. The other thing is that Americans have a lot of private goods. The private markets thrive, and especially in cities, urban areas like Boston, you see a lot of restaurants, a lot of stores open, a lot of goods on the shelf. But what we lack in this country are public goods, goods that we can depend upon in a crisis, things like health care, things like childhood education, things like long-term nursing care. Those are the things that people worry about, and they worry about them because markets tend to be particularly bad at creating those things. And so if the government isn't going to step in and do something about them, then people are going to have to do without
mm-hmm.
them. And so I think the question is not are we, doing well, but are we doing as well as we could be doing, given how rich we are.
James Galbraith has said about the raw deal. Ellen Frank has put her finger on a serious problem, the deliberate use of economic jargon to confuse and mislead. This is a book to undo that. It's called The Raw Deal, How Myths and Misinformation About the Deficit, Inflation, and Wealth Impoverish America. It's available from Beacon. I'll have the information on my website as well. Ellen Frank, thanks for joining me on the Peter Werby Show, as
Thank
usual.
Thank you so much.
This is WRIM.com.
This is Zach Wilde of Black Label Society on the heaviest goddamn station in Detroit, 101 WRIF, The Riff.
Thank you.
101 WRIF Detroit Broadcasting and HD Radio.
You gotta keep them separated.
Separated. Hey!